Blog Talk Radio.
No.
Back in the old days, you know, years ago, they had the A&R men to tell you what to play, how to play it, you know, whether it's disco or rock. But we just went in the studio and we did it. We had champagne in the studio, of course, you know, compliments of the company, and we just laid back and did it. So we hope you enjoy listening to this album half as much as we enjoy playing it for you, because we had a ball. Only real music's gonna last. All that other bullshit is here today and gone tomorrow.
Talking women and vino. The contract like 91 Dan Marino. I swear this guy Michael Rapino's boosting my ego. Overly focused, it's far from the time to rest now. Debates growing about who they think is the best now. Took a while, got the jokers out of the deck now. I'm holding all the cards and niggas wanna play chess now. I hear you talking, say it twice so I know you meant it. Fuck it, I don't even tend it, they should know who's in it. I'm authentic, real name, no gimmicks, no game, no scrimmage. I ain't playing with you niggas at all. My classmates, they went on to be chartered accountants or work with their parents. But thinking back on how they treated me, my high school reunion might be worth an appearance. Make everybody have to go through security clearance. Tables turn, bridges burn, you live and learn. With the ink, I could murder, word of my nigga Irv. Yeah, I swear shit just started clicking, dog. You know it's real when you are who you think you are.
Everything around me.
I had fences, but you had bread. racist. The all black Maybach, but I'm not a racist. Inside's white in the Katy Perry's faces. Yellow diamonds in my Jesus. I just might learn to speak Mandarin. Japanese for the yen that I'm handling. International hoe, that's my handle. My Saint Chong gone, light a candle. El Gran Santo on the mantle. Case y'all didn't know, I speak Spanish too. Shout out the World Wide West. Everywhere we go, we leave a worldwide mess. Yes, still rock La Familia. Says a lot about you if you're not feeling us. The homie said, Hov, it ain't many of us. I told him less is more, niggas, plenty of us.
Jazz crew, everything around me. Freeze. Get the money, dollar bill, y'all.
Cake. 500 million, I got a pound cake. Niggas is frontin', that's upside down cake. Get them a red nose, they clown cakes. I should've never let you round cake. Look at my neck, I got a carrot cake. Now here's the icing on the cake. I'm just getting started, oh yeah, we got it, bitch. I done made more millionaires than Lotto did. They made millions, Biggs made millions. Ye made millions, Just made millions. Leor made millions, Cam made millions. Beans will tell you if he wasn't in the ceiling. I'm back in my bag. My eyes bloodshot, but my jet don't lag. A pair of Jordan 3's trying to chase this cab. Gucci airbag just in case we crash. Last night was mad trill. I'm fresh out of Advil, Jesus rather will.
You know I'm the only one you need. And Peace. This is your host, Sharif. Welcome to High Frequency Radio. You're on the Tuesday night Sharif Foreclosure and Debt Collector Educator Show. Welcome to all the listening audience. Your call-in number is 424-222-5250, 424-222-5250. Give us a call. Press 1 if you have a question today. We'll be going to the lines early. This is your show today, Freestyle Tuesday. I don't have any special guests except for ones that may appear, which is quite possible. You can reach us at email to get on the contact list to be aware and privy to all events that's going on at High Frequency Radio family. You can reach us by email at highfrequencyradioblogtalk@gmail.com. That's highfrequencyradioblogtalk@gmail.com. Give an email to be put on the contact list for any events, webinars, things of that nature that High Frequency Radio family will be holding. As well, when you're on that email list, you also receive a lot of pertinent information that will help assist you in your aid in your quest for education and information. I can be reached at thelawmaster44@yahoo.com, thelawmaster44@yahoo.com. Top of the hour here, I'm just going to go over a few things. We're going to take some questions that I had from the week from listeners and things of that nature about certain debt collection activities, behaviors, do's and don'ts. I'll be addressing those issues here shortly. Just to let the listening audience know, I will be hosting a webinar this Friday, a webinar will be hosted. I believe it's at 3 o'clock. Get on that email list. Email us at highfrequencyradioblogtalk@gmail.com. You will get specific time and information and how you can participate in that particular event this Friday at 3 o'clock, I believe. Okay. Again, our call-in number is 424-222-5250. You can press 1 if you have a question, and you'll be put in the queue and get your questions in early because I'm sure the call is going to fill up here. I want to address and go over our call last week, which is a very, 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 very significant and paramount call. I want to thank my guest again, our priest, Alicia, for showing up and demonstrating and providing us with not only debt collection material and knowledge, but also providing us a very important fundamental ingredient in this quest for debt freedom, and that's the spiritual aspect of it. That call was filled with not only information regarding debt collection, regarding mortgage-related activities, but it also had a very serious and significant spiritual foundation and undertone. And that's one of the elements you will need to be able to go out there and demonstrate any type of debt collection freedom that you are requesting. I also want to thank my special guest, brother and friend, Brother Latif Kareem Bey, for showing up and providing his insight and his knowledge about the debt collection industry and the mortgage-related industry. He provided some jewels for the family. If you didn't listen to that show, you need to go back into the archives and listen to that show. If you want a show that combines not only knowledge and information regarding debt and foreclosure, but also some spiritual tools that you will need dealing with these debt demons, you need to go and listen to that show, download it, and save that into your archives so you can listen to that show throughout the day, whether you're at work, riding around, in your car. Go ahead and burn it to a CD. That is a very, very, very uplifting show for all those that are out there, whether you're experienced or not. Okay, we're going to go into a couple of questions, questions that I have received throughout the week by email, and they're questions I feel significant enough to address so that it will help uplift the family while you're doing defense and offense with respects to debt collecting. First question I have that I want to address is administrative processes. Okay, I receive many emails regarding administrative processes or elements of administrative processes. I'm not a fan of administrative process with regards to how it's styled and titled, because an administrative process I am not able to find in any law dictionary. that has a penalty to it. You may find administrative process in certain commercial arenas and certain commercial laws, but I am not able to attach a penalty or liability to it, so I do not use anything that does not result in me getting some money, all right? And this is why we're in this. We're in this to turn around your debt into cash so that you're able to profit from the violations of law that the debt collectors perform more times than you think, all right? So administrative process in that title, I am not a fan of. There are some things you can do that you may call administrative process, but I don't call it administrative process. If it's not listed, enumerated in 15 U.S.C. 1692 or 1681 or the Telephone Consumer Protection Act, I'm not going to address it because it doesn't allow me a course of action or a private right of action to sue because someone violated some administrative process. So some of those processes include notary defaults and things of that nature and notices of default. You know, you can use and extrapolate some of that information and apply it to your debt collection communications, and you can default them when they don't respond. But I want to go ahead and talk about the response and what requirements are of a debt collector when responding. There was a gentleman on Brother Youssef's show a couple of days ago who asked a question or framed the question to Brother Youssef, and he said, and I didn't have time to call in to answer that question for him, and I want to give a complete answer for those of you that have questions about this, and I do receive questions of that nature. Does a debt collector have a requirement to answer my requests within 30 days? The answer to that question is affirmatively no. The debt collector does not have any requirement, okay, to answer your particular debt validation dispute within 30 days. What we do is we mix up the fact that when a debt collector sends you an initial communication, which is a dunning letter, usually he will have some language that is required by the FDCPA that says, if you do not dispute this debt within 30 days, then they will assume the debt to be true. Okay, that's your requirement. But the law says, and the courts have held, that you don't have to dispute that debt within 30 days. And if you don't dispute the debt, it doesn't become any more valid than it was if he did dispute the debt. So you don't have a 30-day requirement. Let's say you receive it in the mail and you're out of the country. Does that mean that, you know, they now have a default judgment against you or that debt becomes valid by operational law because you failed to respond? No. That is just the debt collector giving you a time frame, which they are unable to do, to say that if you don't respond, they're going to assume the debt is valid. Now, they can assume that all they want, and they probably will assume that either way. Okay, but you don't have a requirement to respond within 30 days. Would it be good for you to do so? Yes, if you receive that communication, there is no reason for you to delay or procrastinate responding with a dispute of that debt. So a debt collector does not have 30 days to respond to you. This is what the debt collector does have to do. All right, they send you a dunning letter, okay, on an alleged debt saying that you owe an alleged debt to some entity. Okay, you send them a dispute, okay, letter under 15 U.S.C. 1692G, and you ask them to validate or verify the alleged debt. What they have to do at that time is to cease and desist all collection activity, including phone calls, letters, emails, things of that nature, until they validate or verify that debt, okay? They can take as much time as they want as long as they do not attempt to collect that debt prior to verifying or validating it. That means if they stop the collection activity and they cease and desist, okay, and they make no further movement on attempting to collect that debt once you sent them a dispute of debt, then they have not violated the FDCPA. If someone tells you you owe them something and you say to them, prove it, and they go away without any further action, then they haven't violated any consumer protection laws until they validate that debt. Now, when they do validate the debt and it's not sufficient enough for you, okay, or to your satisfaction, or if you are a smart consumer, you will realize that they may send you some generic printout statements that purport to allege a debt, then you would be smart enough to know that I don't understand your printouts, your screen printouts, with some charges that's supposed to be verification or validation of a debt. Let's go on what the law says in terms of validation of debts, 15 U.S.C. 1692 G.B. All right. It says that if the consumer notifies the debt collector in writing within the 30-day period described in subsection A that the debt or any portion thereof is disputed or that the consumer requests the name and address of the original creditor, the debt collector shall cease collection of the debt or any disputed portion thereof until the debt collector obtains verification of the debt or any copy of a judgment or the name and address of the original creditor, and a copy of such verification or judgment or name and address of the original creditor is mailed to the consumer by the debt collector. So that just confirms what I just said and supports what I just said, that if you dispute a portion or the entire debt, they must obtain the name and address of the original creditor. The debt collector shall cease collection of the debt, meaning that they shouldn't call you at work, shouldn't send you any more demands, any more dunning letters, until they've obtained either, okay, verification of the debt or a copy of a judgment or the name and address of the original creditor and a copy of such verification or judgment. Okay, so that's their requirements. It doesn't say that a debt collector has to perform those tasks within 30 days. Okay, it just says that they must stop doing what they're doing until they are able to obtain verification or validation of that debt from the original creditor, okay, or a copy of a judgment that they may have gotten against you. In this particular climate where we have illegal debt collection, I'm sure there are many listeners out there that has judgments against them that don't know about it because they wasn't served properly. They might have been served at their previous address. I mean, we have a lot of fraud and games and schemes going on out there amongst the debt collection community. Understand, listeners, that this is a $100 billion a year business, the debt collection arena, okay? Generates $100 billion per year. Okay, I bet you didn't know that. But when you take into account that much of that number accounts for mortgages, then you can understand how that number increases. I'm sure there's not $100 billion worth of defaulted Sprint bills, okay, so and cable bills. So you got to understand that number is inclusive of foreclosure as well, and that is debt collection. All right, so if that answers your question, I wanted that answer to that question to be out there. Debt collector does not have a 30-day requirement. As long as they stop, they cease collecting that debt when you send them a notice of dispute, that is all that is required of them. Okay? Let's go to the next question. The next question that I thought may be important for the listeners is, should I do a bankruptcy to stop a foreclosure sale? And I want to address that because there are certain pitfalls and certain damages one may do to themselves when they start utilizing the bankruptcy court illegally. Okay, and let me explain that. In the last several years since the foreclosure debacle, the bankruptcy courts have been overloaded. Many people, they're saying 4 out of 10 people are filing for bankruptcy. And much of that is due to the foreclosure collapse, the real property collapse in our country. All right. So you have many folks out there and so-called gurus and administrators and consultants that will tell you to go ahead and file a bankruptcy to stop a foreclosure. But many of you will go in and file a bankruptcy. You will pay. Usually they allow payments for you, a payment plan, which is a form of forma paupis, F-O-R-M-A-P-A-U-P-E-R-I-S. okay? That's saying that you have some sort of indigency and you don't have the necessary funds to pay the $350 most of the time filing fee for your bankruptcy. So the court will allow you to promise to pay a payment plan, which you can start off initially with just $50 and pretty much, you know, pay the entire $350 over the course of a few months. They'll give you the opportunity to pick the time limits you're going to adhere to in paying that back, but they don't let it go too much more farther than, you know, a couple of months, because your first meeting of the creditors will be held probably within the first month. So many people will go in there with $50. They'll file a Chapter 7 or Chapter 13, which is called a shadow bankruptcy. You'll file a bankruptcy to stop your sale. What people don't understand is that the courts are aware that this is going on, and they've developed in many states for the federal courts, which bankruptcy is a federal court, they've designed and implemented task force to deal with you that are manipulating or taking advantage of the bankruptcy court by filing a $50 partial payment of the $350, utilizing the bankruptcy automatic stay to stop sale of your $200,000 property, okay? And then you don't follow through. You don't file the necessary documents and schedules, and you don't provide a certificate of the credit counseling, and you don't appear at the meeting of creditors, and usually the court wastes its time and its resources because you're not participating. You did it just to stop a sale. Well, I am aware of several individuals that have done that, and the penalties and liabilities are quite severe. I've known some that has went to jail for abusing the bankruptcy system, and I know some, most of which have been barred anywhere from 180 days on up from ever filing a bankruptcy again. So they take it very serious. You going into a court is just as you going, is no different than you going into a restaurant and ordering two cheeseburgers and two fries and a Coke, and the bill is $10, and you give them $2 and say, I'll be back with the rest. You are stealing. That is theft, okay? If the bankruptcy filing fee is $350, you should be paying that $350, okay? You're paying for a service. That is a bill. You're not going there and say you're broke and you're filing bankruptcy just to stop a sale. Just let me go to the second phase of that question. What is that bankruptcy filing going to do? Is it going to stop your sale? Sure, it'll stop your sale. There's an automatic stay in place. There's an injunction, and the creditors have to go to the bankruptcy court to be able to collect and get permission to collect anything from you. Okay, so yes, it does do that, and we know that. Okay, but that's just for a short amount of time. Okay, because if you don't follow through, they will dismiss your bankruptcy, and they will do it expeditiously. Okay, so you file it, and you get, what, a 30-day reprieve? Okay, because the trustee is going to put the sale back on. All right, you might delay it for a month or two, but the sale is not going away unless you follow through and do a bankruptcy. So my opinion, okay, and my information that I'm giving you, not legal advice, is don't file a bankruptcy unless you actually unless you absolutely have to. And then if you have to, you need to be consulting with a bankruptcy attorney or a bankruptcy preparer. That doesn't have to be an attorney. They have bankruptcy preparers, okay, who are authorized by the court to prepare your paperwork for bankruptcy, all right, and they're allowed to do that and be a non-attorney. If you're not going to have an attorney or a bankruptcy preparer prepare your paperwork and see the bankruptcy through, do not file it. You are taking a big chance at doing so, and it's not going to eliminate the foreclosure issue, okay? If you do decide to go through, then you have many different tools that are able to be utilized in the bankruptcy court. All right, and that would be an adversary proceeding, something like a complaint to determine the validity of the lien. You should Google that and look into that avenue. That gives you the ability to go in and say, hey, court, I don't think that this particular pretender lender has a lien on the property. Because once you file bankruptcy, the first motion or moving document you may see is going to be that the pretender lender is going to file for a motion for relief from stay. And what they're telling the court is that, hey, court, I mean, this guy has no equity in the property. We're the lender, and we need to be relieved from the permanent injunction, from the automatic stay injunction, and be able to proceed with our foreclosure. All right, and that's going to be the first defense, okay, you're going to have to prepare for when filing a bankruptcy. You also have to do credit counseling. You also have to file your schedules correctly, and you also need to know how to fill out those schedules correctly, determining what is secured debt, what is unsecured debt, who should go on schedules and who shouldn't go on schedule, who is your real lender and who is fake. Bankruptcy court is for creditors. They are not for debt collectors. Debt collectors are normally unsecured, and debt collectors rarely appear at your meeting of the creditors because they know that they're going to be wiped out. But in our culture and in our times and these times today, your pretender lender, your debt collectors are coming into the court, and they're acting, masquerading themselves in a Halloween fashion as creditors. And you have to be smart enough to say, bankruptcy court is for creditors, not debt collectors. The only entity that can file a motion for relief is a secured party, not a unsecured party. Are the avenues you need to explore? You have attorneys out there that this is what they do. They do bankruptcy proceedings. It would be wise for you to consult one, or a bankruptcy preparer if you're doing a simple 7 or 13 that's a little bit more complicated. But if you're doing a Chapter 7, you should be consulting with either an attorney or a bankruptcy preparer that can prepare the documents correctly for you. This is not a venue, nor is any court. Although we talk on this show about debt collectors and suing, it is not something one should undertake without having experience or someone next to them that is going to guide them through that process and that avenue. Do not jump out there drafting complaints, suing debt collectors, and you haven't studied and you do not know what you're doing. And speaking of the FDCPA, understand that the FDCPA allows for attorney fees, meaning you can take your case, and if an attorney believes that your case has some merit and some strength to it, he can take that case on a contingency and be allowed to recover attorney fees from the losing debt collecting party. Okay, that is an option that you have. There are plenty of debt collection lawyers out there and attorneys out there. Okay, that does a pretty good job if you can find them. And if you have a good case, okay, they will take your case and they are able to recover attorney fees. So if you don't want to take the time to learn and you don't have the time to learn, or you have a literacy issue that you can't comprehend the legalities of consumer protection laws, then by all means, consult an attorney. And if he feels your case is pretty strong and he can get attorney fees, the law allows attorney fees for consumer protection laws, then go ahead and get you an attorney. I don't care if you have a mortgage case, a credit card case, a power bill case, a cable bill case, it doesn't matter. You can get an attorney, and if he feels your case is winnable, he can go in there without any cost out of your pocket normally, and he can go ahead and litigate that matter for you and obtain the fees from the losing party debt collector. All right? So those are two questions I definitely wanted to answer, put out there to the family and to the public and the community that, do not abuse anyone, but definitely do not abuse any of the laws that are out there, and don't put yourself in the position to where you have a trustee I've had clients that have had the trustee have filers, debtors arrested, okay, because they're filing multiple bankruptcies to stop sales. They know what you're doing. They have access to all of your information. As soon as you file bankruptcy, a lot of times they will freeze your bank accounts. That's another thing you need to be aware of. You have a certain amount of money in the bank, they will freeze all of your assets. Bankruptcy is a very serious, very complicated process, and you should not be abusing it or doing it when you're not really taking intend to take advantage of the full process. But definitely, if you plan on doing something as a short-term remedy, pay your filing fee, okay? You can always dismiss the bankruptcy whenever you want, okay? You can dismiss it sui sponte, on your own, all right? You can dismiss it, but pay your filing fee so the court doesn't come after you saying that, you know, you're abusing the bankruptcy system. But even if you pay your filing fee and you file multiple bankruptcies, you are going to injure yourself. And they have task force and they have trustees that are definitely coming after people for doing so. So don't abuse anyone, including the court system. That's not a way to enter into this arena, okay? So we cover those two questions. I'm going to go to the call line, and we're going to make this show about questions and answers, and hopefully, well, I'm sure that that will segue me into certain topics that needs to be discussed. Let me make sure I'm covering everything I wanted to cover. All right. So we're going to go to the caller line. We're going to start off with 229 ending in 4463. 229 ending in 4463. You're on High Frequency Radio. Welcome to the show. Do you have a question, comment, or concern?
Hey, what's going on? Yeah, I got a question, comment, concern, I guess all three put together. Just heard about on the show.
Okay. What's your name, first of all?
You can just call me R.W.
R.W., all
right? Right. Last name, Bay. R.W. Bay. Okay,
gotcha.
So a couple of months ago, a couple of weeks ago, some people that I know, they introduced me to Yusuf Vail and his and your talk show here. And I heard something. He did this show maybe early on in the year. As a matter of fact, I think the date was the 17th of 2013. But anywho, long story short, I was listening to this stuff. The one he did about the 10 top documents that you can get from the Internet. I'm listening to these things, and I'm listening to the show, so I'm saying to myself, okay, this is good stuff. I'm aware of this stuff ahead of time, but I really don't know the process, the administrative process you just mentioned. I may not be doing some things right, but, you know, I'm listening to the show, and I'm reading the documents. So I'm reading the one about creditors and their bonds Sunday afternoon, listen to the show over and over again. I'm getting some clarity. Didn't get a chance to finish it. Last night, I'm in Atlanta, Georgia, and the job that I go to is in somewhere in Norcross in that area. So I'm getting off work, tired and everything. So I'm going down the road in my conveyance, and all of a sudden I see blue lights and white lights flashing at me. Okay, I know what's going on. So the guy pulls me over, and all the stuff that I heard on the show and everything about the what to say to the officer, that this, that, or whatever, I wasn't even going to get into that. But, you know, the guy stopped me and everything. He said, the reason why I stopped you is because your light bulb over your tag is out. I'm going to be honest with you. I never knew I had a light bulb for my tag. And I've had that truck for a long time. So he goes through these, hey, let me see your driver's license, this, that, or whatever. I do not carry a driver's license anymore. I returned it to the state of Georgia.
Okay, brother, let me interrupt you. This show is about debt collection and mortgage issues. I really don't deal with the traffic issues. That's something that Brother Yusuf will deal with on any other day than Tuesday. But what our show is about, Dedicated Tuesday, is specifically debt collection and mortgage issues. So it sounds like you have a traffic issue, so that question would be sort of out of the realm of what topic we're discussing on Tuesday.
Okay.
Show.
Okay,
brother.
Call back another day.
I appreciate it.
All right.
Yeah, call back tomorrow, and I think these brothers will be able to definitely answer your question. The only thing I would say to traffic is to, you know, make sure you're in that regulatable activity. All right, but we appreciate your call. We're going to go to 770-9898, 770-9898. Welcome to High Frequency Radio. Your line is now open. Do you have a question, comment, or concern?
I have a question. Peace and love to everybody, you, Yusuf, Paul Savage. I appreciate all your information, and I like the way you explain everything.
Thank you, sir.
I have a mortgage question.
All right.
Can I say the name of the bank or don't say it?
You absolutely can.
Okay. I've been with Bank of America, and I just opened up an envelope yesterday. The loan has been sold to a company called PennyMac Loan Services.
PennyMac?
Yeah, PennyMac Loan Services, LLC.
All right.
It's a company out of California. I looked in their website. A lot of people have complaints about them. And like you talked about a couple of weeks ago, the people were saying how their program was set up elementary. They wanted to – people had a lot of problems with this company. All right, and before I even contact them about my loan, I'm trying to see how to deal with it. Now, I went over your first show, and I was taking notes about asking to make the validation of debt, the 1692G. But I was wondering, should I handle it that way, or is there another way I should handle this before I even contact them? Because none of them, they haven't contacted me. They sold the loan on December the 3rd.
Okay.
30,
all right, good question,
I haven't paid November's mortgage yet, and I was current until that time, and nobody has contacted me about this. Just one letter from Bank of America, but nothing from them.
Okay. So you're in default of your alleged mortgage, and please start adopting the language that I use on this show, because the language is going to help you transition your mindset, and your language is important as well as your English language is important. Your legal language when dealing with debt collectors or anyone, even if you're dealing with law enforcement, is going to be very paramount and important to how you communicate. So you're in default as of November, so you just didn't pay your November payment, correct?
Correct.
Now, what day in November was your payment due?
The end of the month. I mean, it's supposed to be in by the 16th, then they charge you a late fee, but then after the 29th or 30th, and you're 30 days late.
All right, so you're not 30 days late as of yet.
Yes, I am, because I haven't paid November.
Okay, so you haven't. So the last payment you made was in October.
That's correct. Correct.
All right, gotcha. So if you're now in default. So November, what day in November did you receive that assignment to PennyMac Service LLC? Yes.
This is notice date was November the 12th.
November the 12th. Okay, so on November the 12th, you were in default. You got a notice of an assignment that the alleged loan was sold to PennyMac Services. Now, I want you to pull up that instrument, and let's go over it and make sure you're precise and accurate in your depiction of that letter, because that's going to be important into how I answer your question. Does that letter say an assignment of servicing rights, or is it a sale or transfer of the loan in its entirety to PennyMac Services LLC?
On December 3rd, 2013, the service of above referred mortgage loan would be transferred to PennyMac Loan LLC.
Okay. So what that is telling you – okay, great. So what that is telling you, and it's important that we read the letters and understand it, they may be conflicting sometime. They may be marinated in legalese, the double and triple and quadruple talk, but we have to understand what is being transferred or assigned. So it sounds like, from what you're telling me, just servicing – of that loan has been assigned to PennyMac Services LLC, and Bank of America still maintained as the alleged creditor or lender in the matter. Okay? So as a servicing, they can transfer and assign servicing right. Okay?
Okay.
That they're allowed to do that. It sounds like there was no sale of the note or the alleged note or the mortgage. They just said, okay, we're busy over here. BAC Home Loans doesn't have the time to deal with this. We're going to send you over to PennyMac Services and let them service the loan. Okay, but as
Got
of
it.
Now, right now, your loan is in default. Okay, once your loan becomes in default, the status of that loan changes. The dimensions and the laws that governs that transaction changes. Okay, you are now in default. If there was an assignment that would come to you that would say, okay, we're selling the loan, the mortgage, the note, whatever have you, it may be a MERS assignment, and I'm going to go into some of those things, but I don't like to confuse our listening audience with mortgage language when we're not dealing with actual mortgages. Some people are. Some people are current. They have a legitimate mortgage. We can talk about those things and the laws that govern those transactions or those statuses. But mostly I'm geared towards the foreclosure arena, and if you're in foreclosure, you're more than likely in default. And if you're in default, then we're presenting to you the laws that go with a defaulted loan, which is the FDCPA and your state consumer protection laws. So you have a servicing transfer, all right?
Correct.
And you're more than likely going to get an assignment subsequently here in the next, you know, maybe week or two, that where they're going to assign that loan to someone else and pursue collections on it, all right? That's when your status changes, when the actual loan or note or any portion part of that is sold. What state are you in?
Right here in Decatur, Georgia.
Okay, so you're in Georgia. All right, so you have a security deed, all right, and it's a non-judicial state, meaning that they do not have to use the judicial system to conduct a foreclosure. So more than likely, it's going to be sent to an attorney, and an attorney is going to do what they call a power sale. Okay, they're going to conduct a non-judicial foreclosure. They're going to advertise it in the newspaper for 4 weeks. Then they conduct the non-judicial foreclosure, and then you're going to subsequently be served with dispossessory papers via eviction. All right, but this is what it sounds like, because the servicing transfer, they sent you notice letting you know that nothing's changed about the ownership of your loan. But the servicing rights has been transferred, and that is fine, all right? Under 15 USD, write this down, 1641G, okay? That's the Tilla-Dodd-Frank Act Amendment. What that says is that any change of ownership, they must notify you, give you the name, address, telephone number, and a direct party to be contacted about your loan. That is going to be should come to you should that loan be sold, okay, or assigned to another entity, okay? That assignment is something you're going to wish for, because if you're now in default, you will now be able to utilize your consumer protection laws against them, because it now is a defaulted debt, and if it was assigned while it was in default, they become debt collectors by operation of law.
Got it.
All right. So let me ask you this. Is your intentions to pay the payment and catch up, or are you in a position to where you're unable to make the payment? Okay.
No, I got behind before, and I caught back up.
Okay. Well, if your intentions are to make the payment and you're just right now you're not even 60 days late, you know, then do the best you could to make the payments and continue to do studying so that you're able to determine.
Uh-huh. Okay, that's the main question I have for you. I need to do some more studying. So you said what's on my mind.
Right, just do some studying. Right. But if you plan on catching up on your payments, you'll be fine. That letter doesn't, to me, just seem like they transfer servicing rights. If they start assigning the entire loan, mortgage, and the alleged security deed and note, then you know that puts you in a better position in terms of utilizing the FDCPA and your state consumer protection laws. It's OCGA 10-1, that's 299 through 319, I believe. But right now, if you have intentions, rather, on catching up your mortgage, I think, you know, if you do it, you know, soon here in the next couple of weeks, it'll be fine. But that letter doesn't alarm me in any way.
Okay, you have my number there. You can see it.
I sure do.
Would you mind taking that down? Then after the show, give me a call. And I know you charge a consultation fee, and we can go into this with more details in private.
Sure. I mean, that's fine, brother. You can always email me and email me your question, and I'll see if it's something I can, you know, thelawmaster44@yahoo.com. I'll see if I can answer that question. But I don't see anything that's really you should be concerned about if you plan on go ahead and catching up with your mortgage payments. But I do suggest that you do some research and determine whether you're paying the correct party. Okay, Bank of America was a successor in interest to Countrywide, and probably quite sure that you, if you were with Countrywide prior, you have definitely a securitized a loan, and you're probably paying the wrong party. So I suggest you check your property records in your county, Okay, and you can do that for free. No, I'm sorry, it's not for free. I think they charge 50 cents per page, but I suggest you look up your property and see if there were any assignments from the inception of your mortgage, meaning that from the time you got the loan, was there any assignments? I'm sure that if you were with Countrywide, Countrywide indeed securitized almost 99% of their loans. So I'm sure it was securitized, and they're just not disclosing that to you. But you definitely need to do some research and determine whether you have the right party, whether you're paying the right party, because it is your responsibility to pay the right party and to ask the proper questions to determine whether you're paying the right party. But I don't think you're in any danger right now, brother. Hopefully that answered your question. You have my email address. If you need anything further, let us know.
Once again, Lawmaster 44.
TheLawmaster 44 at yahoo.com.
TheLawmaster. All right. Peace and love. All right. Thank you.
Peace and love, brother. Thank you. All right. Let's go to the caller lines. We're going to go to 412, ending in 1568. 412-1568, you are on a high-frequency radio. Welcome to the show. Do you have a question, comment, or concern?
Yes, I do. Always a pleasure to hear you. You speak so well and so precise, you know. We're always, you know, perceived as being dumb and unintelligent, but you sound so precise and speak very well. And the question I wanted to ask you is, I'm having a hard time finding out what is the statutory damages for the Fair Debt Collection Practices Act in PA. I know it's called something else. It's the unfair something something. But what is the statutory damages? Do you know?
You said in PA, meaning Pennsylvania?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Well, for the FDCPA, your statutory damages is going to be $1,000, okay, plus. So when you're looking at statutory damages, their statutory amount is what the law allows for the violation. And you will find that under 15 U.S.C. 1692K is the civil liability for violations of that act. All right, and that's $1,000 plus attorney's fees, cost of filing fees, paralegal fees, gas, copies that you might have to do at Kinko's, and all your costs involved are recoverable under the FDCPA. Under Pennsylvania, you have what you call a Fair Credit Extension Uniformity Act, and that's 73 PS 2270.1. that's going to be your state version of consumer protection laws, and the state version has its own laws. They're usually a similar or pale in comparison to your FDCPA, which is your federal law. All right, so, you know, you need to look that up, and under the Fair Credit Extension Uniformity Act, all right, you have, you know, liabilities for unfair or deceptive practices, okay? Some states have separate unfair or deceptive practices act laws, which are consumer protection laws within the state. So you have both, and it's $1,000 statutory. You cannot, and I want to make this clear, that when you're suing on the FDCPA, it is one statutory violation per lawsuit. So the only thing you're going to get when suing is that, I don't care if they sent you 10 letters and 10 violations, you can only get one statutory penalty per lawsuit. But what you also can get is actual damages. What are actual damages? Actual damages are damages that you sustain. Actual damages. Let's say that a debt collector didn't verify a debt and it's on your credit and you couldn't get a job, okay, because they were reporting erroneous information to your credit bureau. Okay, or you were buying a house and in the middle of closing and they put a debt collection on your credit and you're about to close on your $100,000 house, you sent the debt validation to dispute that, didn't respond, they didn't get an opportunity to pay the debt, they didn't send you accurate information to pay the debt, so they cost you your home purchase of $100,000. Those are actual damages that you sustain because of the conduct of the debt collector. You couldn't get that job because they didn't validate a debt or they reported erroneous information to the credit bureau and you sent them a debt validation dispute because you lost that job, because most employers now conduct a credit report or generate a credit report and credit investigation to determine whether they want to employ you. So you were not able to obtain that $50,000 a year job because they were reporting an erroneous, inaccurate information, and therefore you have an actual damage of $50,000. Okay, so an actual damage is an actual damage you sustain as a result of conduct of a debt collector. So you have $1,000 on FDCPA plus costs, okay? And then if you look into and just do some research on your Pennsylvania consumer protection law that I just gave you, then you will see what the damages are regarding that. And the information, you know, the information that they, that the laws that govern consumer, the consumer laws that cover the debt collectors in your state usually is going to mirror in some way the FDCPA, okay? They can't give you false, deceptive, or misleading representations. They can't harass, abuse, or oppress you. They can't call you after a certain time at home. You know, they can't do deceptive practices or unfair deceptive practices against you, so it can't threaten to do things that they're not able to legally do. So, you know, you have those laws in favor of a consumer in your debt collection cases. So it's $1,000, brother, statutory, okay, plus cost. So if you had a $350 filing fee and you had $200 worth of copies and you had to drive to court maybe for a hearing, which is unlikely because if you use a federal court, you rarely would have to appear. You have whatever cost that you have in there, that's what you're able to cover plus the $1,000 statutory amount. And also what you need to take into the fact that if you did sue a debt collector, more than likely the debt that you're suing them upon, they will eliminate that from your credit report once you even file suit. So you're accomplishing a lot of things when you do file suit. If you're prepared to do so against a debt collector, they're usually going to erase that debt, and they're usually going to not try to collect on that particular debt. Does that answer your question, brother, or do I need to go further?
Well, but some of the stuff I knew, but I didn't want to cut you off because other listeners might not have known that. But what you did say is each one of those letters, you know, you're only going to get $1,000, but isn't each one of those letters a separate cause of action that a person is entitled to sue for each one of those letters?
Yeah, you will in a separate lawsuit. I mean, but if they send you 10 letters and you, right, if you, well, yes, they're going to be separate causes of action, but the results is if you are successful, they're only going to give you one statutory violation. So, you know, you can load up with 10 just in case the judge doesn't see 9 of them. Then you can say, okay, well, in the 10th cause of action, yeah, I can see them violating that. So I'm going to go ahead and award you damages for, you know, the 10th one. So you want to load up as much information as you can regarding your causes of action just in case the judge doesn't, you know, see eye to eye with you on some of the violation that you allege they committed. So, but you're only going to get one statutory violation liability amount.
Okay, well, let me ask you this then. Like, say if a law firm is a debt collector and there's three attorneys, like, you know, thief, other thief, and criminal. There's three of them. Isn't that a statutory damage for each one of those attorneys?
Well, yes. Well, if you have – well, attorneys – and this is another question I wanted to address. Attorneys are debt collectors. Most of the time, there is no parachute for them. If they are collecting debt, okay, as a regular course of work for their business, they are debt collectors. That's why you always include them in your communication when they are communicating with them. And you let them know in your communications, okay, that pursuant to 15 U.S.C. 1692A6, you are a debt collector, and pursuant to 1692A3, I am a consumer. You are not, pursuant to 1692A4, a creditor, and you are, pursuant to 1692A5, collecting a debt. So you just lay them out and let them know who I am, who you are, what you're trying to collect, okay, and what you are not, okay? And that's what your letter wants. That's the contents of your letter. I want to identify who you are, what you're trying to collect, all right, who I am, all right, and who you are not. So you want to make that statement in your first opening paragraph to let them know. And then you want to go ahead down the line. So if you have three debt collectors collecting, three attorneys collecting on the same debt, sure, you can file a complaint and list those three different defendants. And, yes, each defendant will owe you one statutory damage of $1,000. So if you have four defendants committing violations of the consumer protection laws, then, yes, you will get $1,000 plus cost times four because you have to litigate against four defendants.
Okay, that answered my question. I only have one more question now. Because they send you they call it memoranda letter, or you have 30 days to validate this debt or dispute this debt. What law, even though you don't say you don't get the letter, what law gives a third party debt collector that you owe them? Is there a law to say, hey, well, since you didn't answer this letter, you didn't dispute this debt? What law is saying that you owe a third-party debt collector? Because I've never gotten clarity on that, because it's saying you owe no third-party debt collector.
Sure. Let me ask you the question. Do you owe a debt collector any money?
No.
All right, then. You answered your own question. You don't owe a debt collector. Did a debt collector any loan you any services or any money, make a loan to you, offer you any services? Did they cut your grass? Did they bring meat to your house? Did they deliver a turkey to you? Did they offer you? Did they give you phone service? No. So the answer is no. You don't owe a debt collector any money. But let me say this: one of the violations you may be able to pick up on in a lot of these Dunning letters, and Dunning letters are communication from debt collectors. That's what they're called, Dunning, D-U-N-N-I-N-G. So what you will find is that a lot of times they're putting this in a Dunning letter. You have 30 days to dispute the debt in writing. I want you to look for that. I want the family and the community and the listening audience to look for that deceptive language in your letters. If they say that you have 30 days to dispute the debt in writing, that is a violation of the FDCPA, because you do not have to dispute the debt in writing. You can dispute the debt verbally. You can dispute the debt if you've seen the debt collector at the club and he asks you about the debt. You understand? Long as you dispute that debt, you don't have to do it in writing. If they gear you towards a particular manner of which you have to dispute, that is a violation, and the courts have upheld that. That is a violation to say that you have to dispute it in writing. You don't have to. Say you were out. Say you were in the military, was in Russia, and your wife said, "Honey, we got this debt collection letter from ABC Debt Collection Company, and they're saying you got to dispute it in writing, but you're not here." Okay? You don't have to do that. You can get on the phone, call them from Russia, or get on Skype and be like, "Hey, you sent me a letter. I don't know what debt you're talking about. I don't recall having a debt with this creditor, and I dispute the debt, and I'm pursuant to 1641G, 15 USC, I'm asking that you validate or verify the alleged debt." You can say that over the phone, and that is considered a dispute, and they have to take action pursuant to 1692G in providing you with validation of that particular debt. So there is no law that says you owe a debt collector, okay, if that answers your question. But if you admit to owing a debt, then a debt collector, okay, in some cases, very rare, may have a right to sue you on that particular debt. They got a right to sue you. They got a right to ask you for anything. And what we have to do is start understanding language that is used in our society, whether you're dealing with civil or criminal matters, is that many people will tell you, "Well, we have the right to ask you for this, that, or the third," or "We have the right to ask you for," since a very common topic is traffic, "we have a right to ask you for certain information when we have you under custodial arrest, or we're questioning you, or we're interrogating. We got a right to ask." Yes, I understand that. You have a right to ask. The law allows you to ask me those questions. The law allows certain companies and entities to ask you for a Social Security number. The law requires that they ask you for a driver's license, okay? The law allows them to ask you for a litany of information, but you, the law, doesn't say that you have to answer any of those questions. In fact, the law says that you don't have to. Okay, no one can force you to ask you any to answer anything. So my response is always, yeah, I understand the law allows you to ask me those questions, but I don't have to answer them. You asked the question, and I declined, okay, or denied answering them. So what's next? The power is in me and always is in me. You can't force me to do anything. In order for you to force me to do something, you have to go further in the law and use other laws to be able to compel me to do something that I don't want to do. Meaning if I don't want to answer your question, I'm not going to answer it. If I don't want to provide you with any information, then I'm not. If I call the debt collector and they say, well, can I have, we need your Social Security number. Well, I don't want to give you that. Well, the law says that I have to ask for one. You have to listen to what they're saying. Yeah, I understand that. And the law does say you have to ask for one, but it doesn't say I have to give you one. And I'm not giving you one. So all I'm doing is disputing information. You sent the letter to me. I'm not providing you with any information. I'm not providing you with an address. I'm not providing you with a Social Security number. I'm not accepting any knowledge or even giving you any credence about the alleged debt. I don't know what you're talking about. I don't recall a debt with American Express. I don't recall a debt with Wells Fargo. I don't recall a mortgage with Citibank. I don't recall any of that information. You need to validate and verify that debt. And until you do so, you have to cease and desist all collection activity, okay? You have to cease all calls until you do so. Does that answer the question, brother?
Yeah, okay. What I'm going to do is I'm going to email you, and
sure
I have your email address. But in closing, just the difference between assignment and purchasing. And I'm going to just listen in after that.
Okay, well, an assignment of a loan, a lot of times you'll see assignments of a mortgage, an assignment of a deed of trust, an assignment of a security deed, and then sometimes you'll get letters that says that they are assigning the servicing rights, okay? Servicing rights is just we have somebody else serving your account. If you're in a restaurant, we're not going to let – Pamela, the waitress over here, we're going to have Ed service your table. It's just servicing, okay? And they can send it to any servicer they want. A servicer has very limited authority and very limited power. But what you will find is that most servicers these days, and servicers are debt collectors, okay? And the courts have upheld that. Servicers are debt collectors, and you will see that mini Miranda, which states this is an attempt to collect the debt. We are a debt collector, and any information used will be used for that purpose. That is your conscious pricking, so to speak, to let you know, hey, Brother Sharif, FDCPA, that's my language. That's my cue, okay? I'm changing my terminology. I'm changing laws now because they have already stated in their communication they're a debt collector. So now I can practice on the servicer. Okay, but the servicer is supposed to be acting for a principal or acting for a lender. Okay, so they're the in-between person. They're going to communicate your correspondence with the lender, okay, which many times they're not. They're just going to answer the question themselves, okay? And they're supposed to communicate that to the lender, and the lender is supposed to make decisions, okay? The lender makes all decisions in any kind of mortgage, deed of trust, security deed transaction. Only the lender has authority to do X, Y, and Z, not a servicer. So if a servicer sends you a notice of default, okay, and it's not from the lender, that is a violation of the FDCPA. Why, brother? Because a servicer can't threaten to foreclose on you. Only the lender has that authority. And if you read your deed of trust or you read your security deed because you're in Georgia, you will see that only the lender has that authority to send a foreclosure notice. The servicer must tell, okay, well brother won't pay. Okay, well, he won't pay? All right, how many months is he behind? All right, well, go ahead and send him a letter saying that if he doesn't, then, call him and tell him, send him a letter. So as the servicer, we're saying that you're in default of the mortgage and you could receive foreclosure proceedings subsequently if it's not paid. Well, then the lender has to send you that notice of default, okay, the actual notice of default, not the fact that you're in default. The lender will have to send you that notice of default and notice of acceleration. okay, and notice of foreclosure, because that is the only person authorized to do so within the four corners of your deed or your security deed or your deed of trust. All right? Hopefully to answer your question, brother, you can always reach me on the email if you need anything further, but I appreciate the question, and it was definitely a good question, and hopefully it helped.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, brother. All right, we're going to go to the next caller. 203-5872, you are on High Frequency Radio. Welcome to the call. Do you have a question, comment, or concern? 5872?
Yes, right. Brother, you hear me? Brother, you hear me?
All right, brother, I can hear you now. I cut you off. But
oh,
I
yes, sir,
right
brother. Thank
off.
You for taking my call, brother. Now, your email is the or just Lawmaster?
It's the Lawmaster.
Okay, I was wondering why. I had a question on I had acquired an automobile at one time in 2002. I returned it within 72 hours, but a shady dealer brought the car to a location and dropped it off. And I was tendering payments for like 3 months, and then I allegedly went into default. It's been going on for 2 years, and they finally they had an attorney. I was dealing with a general attorney who represented this credit union who they assigned the alleged security agreement to. And then and then like 3 months later, an attorney out of the blue brought me into court. And I sent the validation of that and all that. I mean, I hear that you say that, but sometimes what happens when they ignore it, or if they say they're representing credit union? I mean, how do you know? And if they validated that, if they send you like an affidavit from the general manager who says I handle the book. I mean, I'm sure they send it the same kind of. What is the validation of that?
Well, you know, automobile loans are debts, but what you have to understand is that there's a lien interest recorded, and many a time when automobile loans, they don't sell those loans many times. They may sell, if they repossess your car and there's a deficiency balance, they may sell that particular deficiency balance to a collection agency to collect on the deficient amount. But normally when you're dealing with a lien holder, the attorney is usually working for the creditor. So that means they will be a creditor under 1692A4. And they'll usually send communications, say, hey, we're calling on behalf of Bank of America who funded your automobile loan, and you're in default. We need to get our property or get you to pay. All right. So you're in many cases, you are dealing with the creditor because they are your lien holder. So they wouldn't be, in many cases, considered a debt collector. Now, you said you returned the car within 72 hours, which is a cooling off period. You have in many states allow for a cooling off period, meaning that you know, many times we make purchases based on emotion, and salespeople know that. That's why it's their job to get you a cup of water, make you feel real nice, ask you some questions about the kids, you know, give the kids a lollipop. You know, we understand that it's an emotional decision when we're making purchases. So the law in some states allows for some cooling off period, some 24 hours, some 48, some 72, where you can return that purchase and be like, you know what, you know, it was the heat of the moment. I made an emotional decision, or my wife went out, you know, she was feeling bad, so she made this purchase. We decided it wasn't in our best interest. So pursuant to the cooling off period, and usually that's in your contract from the dealership. So the cooling off period allows you to cancel that transaction without any penalty, just return the merchandise and have to return any down payment and things of that nature to you. But it sounds like you said you returned it
A week later they dropped it off. They dropped the automobile off. So I was dealing. A week later.
Okay. They wouldn't be allowed to do that because when you buy a vehicle from a dealer, okay, there's what is called a first payment default, all right? And they will always tell you that make sure whatever you do, you make the first payment because they have a repurchase agreement with the bank. So that means the dealer is just a merchandiser, okay? Dealers, some dealerships are buy here, pay here. They have in-house financing, in-house meaning that they fund the financing. But outhouse financing mean they use another lending source to be able to have their merchandise paid for you. So if you right. went to the dealer and you purchased the car and you returned it within 72 hours. Now, this is what I have to have you understand. Let's say you went to the dealership, you had questionable credit, and they let you go ahead and what they call they spotted you on a car, meaning that they felt enough about your credit that they would be able to get one of their secondary lenders or one of their lenders pick it up, but they had to iron out the you know the particulars with the bank. So they spot you in the car, meaning that they let you take the car home, but they had a contingency or disclaimer inside of that buyer's order or what they call a law contract, which is a temporary contract that puts you on that says that, hey, we haven't secured funding for you, so you will be called back into the dealership within a day or two once we get it approved through a bank, and you agree to come back and sign the final paperwork to consummate the deal. So within that time, you have 72 hours, okay, to cancel it. But from the time you could, let's say they called you back the next day and say, okay, we found the bank, you know, your payments are going to go up a little bit or go down a little bit or it might require some more down payment, but we need you to come on in. And let's say you go in there and you sign that contract, which is going to be probably an 8x14. It's a long contract. It's called a retail installment contract. And it's it's called a law contract, is what the terminology is used in the finance.
What if you reserve all your rights when you sign the contract?
I mean, that's fine. I mean, you're just reserving
your
rights
for
any Sure.
Right, I did. But like I said, it's just, it's just been a big headache for me.
Right. But if you sign that new contract, the law contract I was saying, and you returned it within 3 days, then, you know, if your law supports that, then and if you return the car and they returned it back to you, and you took the car back and you made payments on it, then you consummated the agreement. Okay. You entered into a contract. You should have said, I don't know why you dropped this car back off. I'm canceling the deal. You should have contacted the bank that's on the paperwork and say, hey, I canceled the deal. Please tell your vendor, your merchandiser,
yeah,
your
I did
dealer.
All, yeah, I did all that. I did all that. Actually, I did all
but
that.
But then you wind up keeping it. So for whatever reason, maybe they talked you into it or maybe
no,
the fact that they were aggressive.
Just, you know, it's just, I mean, I had the lack of knowledge at the time.
Sure. Well, that's okay. I mean, but right now, you know, if you have an attorney that's going to sue you on that the balance of that contract, he can do so. And he's not necessarily a debt collector as long as he's acting in and for the creditor. So if he's working for the lien holder and that lien holder matches the communications you're getting from the attorney debt collector, then he's within his rights to pursue a legal debt.
Can you ask the alleged loan lender, because it was assigned, so I don't know if there was a loan or not, but can you ask
them? So it was assigned to someone else?
No, the security agreement was assigned to a credit union. They didn't actually give me a loan. They just assigned it.
Okay. So who was your original, who funded your loan? The original bank that's on your original paperwork, who funded the loan?
No, it was an auto dealer. Which is signed.
Auto dealers doesn't fund loans. Okay. So they assigned it on you. So what happens when you go, you hear me out, when you go to purchase a car, okay, they're going to do a contract. And on that contract, the contract is going to assign that contract to a lender. They have to do that because they don't, dealerships don't finance their own loans. So they assigned it to a credit union at that time. They have credit unions that buys their loans. They have banks and they also have credit unions, okay? So if they assign your original loan to that credit union and that credit union put the lien on your vehicle, that is your creditor. They're not debt collectors.
Okay.
Okay?
Okay.
But it's not an assignment in terms of it started off with Bank of America, then they assign it to a credit union. That usually rarely happens in automobile loans. They're just going to assign your contract at that interest rate, and they found a bank that would buy it for that rate using your credit, and they assigned it because the contract is a retail contract. They just assigned that contract to the credit union, and the credit union who is who paid for your automobile. So they will be
right.
considered the creditor and the lender. Now, the communication
okay.
from the attorney is going to say, hey, we work for XYZ Credit Union, and we're calling you because you're in default on your auto loan. We need you to return the merchandise or arrange to have us pick, to have it picked up.
Right.
Okay, or
right,
they can institute an action against you, a replevin
right.
against you to go ahead and have the court mandate that you return that merchandise.
Right, but on their communication, they say this is an attempt to collect a debt. Is that considered a debt collector or a creditor?
You said, say it again? Yeah, it's an attempt to collect a debt. Well, yeah, that's maybe what the attorney was saying. He's collecting a debt.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
Now, I don't know
okay.
what your letter says, but if it references that he's acting on behalf of the credit union who is the lien holder, okay,
right.
he doesn't have any personal knowledge, so he might just put that in there to say, I'm attempting to collect the debt. It is a debt. It's going to be understand that, you know, the FDCPA does apply to creditors in some sense, depending on how they're collecting the debt, whether they're collecting it in their own name or they're using someone else's name. They're going to put that language in there to cover for themselves in some way. But your credit union, if they're the lien holder, is not necessarily a debt collector. They're a creditor because
okay.
they lent you the money. They hold the lien on the property.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. But I'm
all
saying,
right,
like, if attorneys, yes, sir. I'm just saying, if attorneys
mm-hmm.
send you a letter, how do you know if they represent or they brought the debt? I mean, how do you know that, though?
Well, that's a good question, and let me answer that two ways. One, you don't know unless you ask, because many times you are right. Attorneys are usually the owners of many debt collection agencies. Okay,
right.
They are the owners of these debt collection agencies. They buy these defaulted debts. So, you know, it could have been purchased. So what you want to do is write a communication to the original creditor and get them to respond to you in writing. I'm receiving communication from an attorney who says they are acting on behalf of you. I need confirmation that this attorney is acting on your behalf and you
okay.
haven't sold, transferred, or otherwise the debt to anyone else, and get them to put that in writing.
Okay, that's good. That's good to know. Okay, that's the most important thing I need to know. Thank you, brother, so much for answering my question. Thank you.
Thank you, brother. Hopefully that helps. All right. All right, let's go to our next caller here, 202-4089. 202-4089. You are on High Frequency Radio. What's your question, comment, or concern?
Yes, how you doing?
Doing well. What's your name, brother?
Daryl. Daryl from D.C.
All right, Daryl. Great. Welcome to High Frequency Radio. How can we help?
Thank you. I have a couple of questions. Number one question is, if the alleged creditor sends you a letter about a debt and you don't react in those 30 days, can you still respond, you know, anyway? Say if it's been, in my case, maybe 90 days.
Sure, absolutely. What that means is the debt collector wants to know, and they have a right to know what your challenges are to the alleged debt. So they ask you
okay.
to respond within 30 days because they don't want to be waiting indefinitely to get
okay.
a response, whether they need to proceed, whether they need to log the deal, book the deal, or whether you're going to do like the students and the listeners on my show and start attacking them with letters of dispute. So if you start attacking them with a letter of dispute, I'm telling you many times, 7 out of 10, if you get a dunning letter from a debt collector and you draft one of the letters similar or identical to the letters that I draft for debt collectors, you're not going to hear from them again, and they're not going to put the letter on your credit, and they're going to throw it to the side because they're going to weigh out, okay, this person knows something, they're attacking us, they're sending us a letter that is marinated in consumer protection laws. We're looking at the amount. We're looking at how much we paid for it. Now we don't want to deal with him. We're just going to throw that away, and you'll never hear from them again. So let's say it's been 60 days, and you just got wind of the letter. Send them a notice of dispute anyway. What it's going to tell them is that they might have a case that they may want to pursue judicially, and if you don't respond, they may proceed on it and say, well, we gave them 30 days because we said, you know, we're going to continue collection action if you don't dispute within 30 days. So they may send it to an attorney and start legal action against you, or they may start some other collection activity against you. So, you know, the 30 days, no, you're not held to that standard. That's just what they're requesting that you do. So they don't proceed taking additional action when you actually have a dispute.
Okay. And it was actually in reference to a house where they were basically saying I could, it was probably giving me an option to maybe remodify the loan to one of my houses. And,
well, I speak about that often, brother, and I want you to listen to me very closely and clearly, and I want you to go back and listen to the preceding two shows or three shows that I've done. You have to be very, very mindful of the modification scam. There are hundreds, if not thousands, of lawsuits right now against these pretender lenders for violation of modifications. Okay, the modification scam is this. They'll have a bad mortgage debt, alleged debt, okay, that's been securitized, chopped up, sold up. They don't know who owned it. They don't know what's going on. They want to clean up that title issue. They want to get your signature on a new document that alleges a debt. So the first thing they're going to send out to you, they're going to look at your case. They're going to look at how much equity you got. I'm going to tell you, brother, they're going to look at every dimension of your home to determine what action they're going to take. If their paperwork is real bad, and they know that they have some issues, or they know that maybe the previous servicer or creditor or alleged creditor fumbled a lot of things and filed some bad documents in the county recorder. If they see that their case is difficult, then the first thing they're going to do off the rip is send you a modification packet. If they see that you have some equity and they see that you're in a pretty prominent area or you have a pretty nice prime real estate property, all right, I don't care what kind of paperwork it is, they're going to send it to the attorneys and say, we need to get that property. We need to foreclose on that by all means, all right? But many times they're going to send you a modification because the modification scam is, and I broke this down on my last show or the show before that, and you need to listen to that because this is going to be a series as in school. You're going to have grade 1, 2, 3, all the way up to college. So I'm breaking it down from the beginning to the end, so we always need to go back ab initio to the beginning of my shows so you can have an understanding that when you appear on future shows, you have an understanding of the foundation and the language. But they're going to send you a modification and hope that you sign some paperwork with them. Once you sign some paperwork with them, they're going to do two things. They're going to allege that you owe a debt. You're not going to dispute it. You're going to fill out a modification paperwork. You're going to agree to a new account number, okay, not your old account number, not the account number that has an OMB number attached to it, okay? You have to dispose of one account before you can open another, okay? So if you went to the bank and you wanted to change bank accounts and you say, well, listen, I have some fraud on that account or, you know, I had someone process a check and I'm kind of, you know, afraid for identity theft, so I need to change account numbers. They're not going to leave that account number and establish a new account number. They're going to close one account and open up another. So if you have a debt collector coming after you, the first thing they're going to do is says your new account number is this. And if you agree to that, then you've just now acquiesced and agreed to a new account number that has a number, an amount attached to it. And if you communicate with any correspondence referencing their new account number that they just created out of thin air, then you're validating a debt and you're saying that you agree you owe a mortgage, you agree that they're a creditor, you agree that they're able to modify a loan, which they are not because they're not a creditor, and you're going to fill out that paperwork and they're going to send you a fancy letter and they're going to say, you know, your payments could be reduced from $2,000 to $1,000, you're going to be like, wow, that's half. Let me fill out this paperwork. But you are absolutely committing credit suicide by doing so. Now, understand when I say that, you have to have the requisite knowledge to be able to not do so and be able to have the results favorable to you. But if you don't have that ability, then a modification may sometime afford you or provide you with some relief. But what you're doing is because the debt collector doesn't have much or anything tied up monetarily in your loan, a modification is good as gold because it increases their book debt to 100% or close to when they only paid pennies or really was assigned or transferred for hardly nothing. And when you look at most of your assignments, you see that the language within it is that it was assigned for valuable consideration. Well, we all know That's really nothing. That's a fancy way of saying I'm not telling you what I paid for it. You know, I might have paid some chickens or some meat. I might have swapped some cows or some horses. But, you know, it's valuable consideration. But they have to be able to show you where they paid a certain amount for the debt, meaning debt collectors will usually pay anywhere from 5 to 10% on the dollar of each loan. So if they paid, if you have a $100,000 mortgage, they might have paid, okay, anywhere from $5,000 to $10,000. But they're billing you for $100,000 plus every payment you missed 5 years ago, plus interest, penalty, late fees, and all that. So they're asking you for $150,000 on a debt they might have paid $5,000 or $10,000 for. So when you send a modification in and you say, I want to modify the $150,000 you say I owe, they'll say, okay, well, we'll knock off $50,000 and charge you $100,000. They still came up $95,000, and now they have a whole new contract that you're going to enter into in their name, waiving all the defenses you might have had on the previous loan number in the previous alleged mortgage account. Do you see the scam?
Oh, definitely. That was one reason why I didn't sign it, and I didn't respond. I not only didn't go for it, but I didn't at that time dispute it either. I just kind of it's just been kind of like hanging there.
Sure. Sure. You know, you're sending me modification paperwork, and many times what you'll see, too, part of that modification scam is, let's say your loan was securitized, and it indicates that by referencing that your loan is owned by Bank of New York Mellon, let's use for an example, as trustee for the ABC 123 certificate holders, you know, 2005-14. Okay, so that's your indication that your loan was sold into the secondary market, and they're going to send you paperwork to modify that. Well, one, you need to look into the pooling and service agreement and see if the pooling and service agreement, or affectionately styled as the PSA, allows for modifying. But usually when you look at the pooling and service agreement and your Dunning letters that you received, you will see that when the modification paperwork comes in, it's not listing the securitization trust, the Bank of New York, CWABS, you know, 123-2005. They're not listed or named in the modification paperwork. So if they send you a letter saying that the trust, the securitized trust, or REMIC owns it, but then your modification paperwork is with the servicer, or the person that's sending you notices saying that you owe the money, then why is the trust not named in the modification paperwork? Okay, so that's, we have to be very cognizant and very aware and read our communications and understand them. And for the listening audience, if you have a problem, okay, if you have a problem or literacy issues, and I don't mean that offensively, but if you have a problem reading certain letters, you need to save those letters and bring those questions to the call so that I'm able to translate and discern that information for you and be able to give you its true meaning so you understand what you're doing and what they're saying. There are many times myself and even Brother Savage or Brother Youssef will read those letters, and we'll determine that they're doing a bunch of hogwash talking. They're triple speaking, they're not making any sense, their sentences are colliding, okay, it doesn't make any sense. We're saying this is what they're saying. They're ultimately saying nothing, okay, but this is what you need to do. So bring those letters forth, bring them to the show, save them for Tuesday on Sharif's show, and I'll be able to translate that information for you. But the modification thing, brother, is going to be something that you have to make a personal decision on for your family, because until you acquire the necessary information needed to defend yourself, I wouldn't tell you to put your family in jeopardy by losing your house or going up against a law firm or, in many cases, a corrupt judicial system by trying to fight those matters and wound up having an opportunity to be homeless. So you have to look at those things. I would reserve your rights on anything you do with regards to a modification. And understand this, you can always go back later. There's no statute of limitations on fraud. They're going to say they're modifying a loan, but you can't modify something that's broke. Okay, if you got a bad engine, you know, the mechanic will tell you, hey, man, the engine's bad. I can paste it together, I can modify this, maybe tape up, you know, a hose, maybe put some glue around it. It's not going to last long, but, you know, that'll modify it enough for you to get around, but ultimately you're going to need a new engine. So the modifications is what they're saying, you need a new loan. We need to clear up all those issues. We need your signature on some new documentation waiving the defenses of the old loan that we know has been extinguished by many different reasons for credit default swap insurance, because it was sold, because the original lender is in bankruptcy. You know, it's a litany of reasons why that loan is no longer enforceable. The other thing you have to look at, brother, is the statute of limitations. There is a statute of limitations. Debts don't last forever. And you have to look that up for your state to determine what the statute of limitations is. If you last made a payment on your loan right now in 2009 and the statute of limitations for your state is 3 years, they can't enforce your mortgage, your alleged mortgage. Statute of limitations is gone. They've told their time to be able to collect that mortgage. That makes it unenforceable. So I don't care what they send. Can they still send letters trying to collect the debt from you? Yes, absolutely. But that doesn't mean, again, the law allows them to ask. The law allows them to request, but it doesn't mandate that you have to answer or respond to anything. Does that answer your question, bro?
Yes, it does. Thank you very much.
I appreciate your question, and have a good day. All right, we're going to go down to 917 New York, 917-1024. 917-1024, you are on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question, comment, or concern?
Sure, my brother. Peace.
Peace, peace.
It's my first time able to get on a Tuesday. I've been wanting to get at you.
All right.
You spoke briefly when you first came on before you got your own spot. But anyway, I have a unique situation. I also was listening about the young man with the assignee thing, with the car thing. Let's start with that first. Now, I had a situation where I leased a car, completed the lease, and then they allegedly sold, you know, me buying it out, they allegedly sold whatever the next amount to another bank. It was assigned to them.
Okay.
There's no actual loan. So how could they act also as a creditor? Even they call themselves a financial institution, but they never gave me any funds. They just took on a lien or debt and started charging me and took no financial risk.
All right, I'm a little bit lost on that. So you leased the vehicle and you paid the entire terms of the lease. Let's say it was 36-month lease, and you pay that. Usually what happens prior to the expiration of your lease is that they'll send you a notice saying, hey, they'll offer you some deals. They'll say, listen, if you want to refinance the balance of your lease, we'll do that at 5.9% interest rate, 72 months, things like that. But if not, you know, your lease expires, let's say, you know, December 2013, you have to turn in your car. It has to be in a certain condition. You know, the damages can't be no more than a quarter size in diameter, you know, things of that nature.
Right.
Did you turn in the car at the end of the lease or did you not?
No, I kept it. On the last day, we made a deal where they were supposed to be finding another lender to buy out that extra, the X amount, like you said, that allegedly is supposed to be left on there.
So why didn't you turn it in when you? Okay, so they could
have gotten
a deal.
The car.
You wanted to keep the car, but did your credit allow you to do so?
Yeah, but they said they wouldn't finance it; they would find another bank.
Okay, so they said they would find another bank to finance it.
Right. And then they assigned it, or they said they found the bank. They said they found the bank.
All right.
Right? So when I found out about this credit scam and all of this, you know, I was paying it, you know, in good faith and so forth. So as I learned, so I started asking questions and realized they never actually made a loan. But they were calling themselves a creditor.
All right, I got to understand you, brother. Okay, and let me go a little bit slower here. So you paid, you took the lease to the end. You decided you wanted to keep the car. You applied for financing with the original lessee who leased you the vehicle, and they said, well, we're not able to offer you financing, but we have somebody else that can. So that somebody else, another entity, came in and said, okay, we'll refinance the balance of the lease. And you said you paid some payments on that arrangement, correct?
Right, in good faith, under the impression that it was an actual contract and performance on their part.
Okay. Well, why do you think it's not when you were able to keep the vehicle beyond its lease maturity and you were able to make payments? Because obviously, you know, the original bank who leased the vehicle to you, let's say it was Toyota Motor Company. Say they lease your vehicle for 36 months. At the end of it, they said at the end of the lease, you'll have a balance. Say the vehicle is $20,000. At the end of it, say you'll have $10,000 left, and you can finance the balance, keep the car, pay it out, each title, or you can turn it in, walk away, and go get you another one. So you, at the end of your lease, you decided you wanted to keep it. They sent you over to another company who financed the balance, and they would have to finance the balance. When you say they assigned it, they probably just assign the balance of your lease because they hold title. Okay, let's say it's Toyota. They hold title, so they assign that contract for the remaining of the balance to be that note to be held by a different financing source. That financing source you got involved with, contracted with, agreed to make certain payments until the balance of the lease was paid, which means you can get obtain title. Okay, once that last payment is made, you made some payments to that new company. They're not a debt collector. They're a creditor because they paid off Toyota to get that.
That's the thing. There was no evidence of that. They did not. There was no performance. There was no evidence of any funds transferred between neither one of them.
Right.
Okay.
But,
so
but brother,
the mere
fact that you still have the car, okay, beyond the lease maturity date says that somebody else is financing the balance of your lease. I mean, when you say it's nothing, you said you made payments to this new company. There had to be a contract.
It wasn't a good faith contract. But also, it's my understanding that when you do a lease, that the vehicle is paid off from the beginning, that they get the full amount for that vehicle anyway.
Right. When you
so they double.
Well, yeah, they pay
so
the
really,
full amount. When you do a lease, let's say the car is $25,000, they're going to finance $25,000. But because you have the creditworthiness and ability and purchasing power to be able to buy just a portion of that vehicle's life, they're going to say, okay, the car's $25,000. You know, a vehicle's lifespan is 5 years, so we're going to give you 2.5 years of that vehicle's life, meaning that 12.5 is what we're going to lease, and we're going to make payments. You're going to make payments based on buying half of the vehicle's life, meaning that $12,500 is going to be divided into a lease factor, not an interest rate. A lease factor.
I understand, Brother Sharif, how it works.
Okay, brother.
So the
balance of that loan had to be financed by somebody.
What I'm purporting, it's the same thing with the mortgage thing.
Mm-hmm.
All right? It's paid up in full beginning before you even move in. They take it from my estate. Okay? So we should not have to be paying again. So I'm purporting when I did the lease, they took the full amount from my estate, from the U.S. Treasury, from my account. You understand? So it was paid in full. That's what I'm purporting.
Okay. Now I'm understanding. Uh-huh.
Right. So this pretender lender have no evidence of performance, but they call themselves a creditor. Anyway, the bottom line is I offset it to a closed account, in good faith, properly, but they didn't play ball. Come to find out that this so-called creditor had a problem in Texas, in their hometown in Dallas, in 2011. They were the most complained about corporation where the state Secretary of State had to step in. All right, so I knew it was a problem with them because they wasn't operating in good faith, especially after I discharged the debt or offset it. Okay, so that was the situation with that. You want to say anything else on that?
Yes, I will say something on that. I'm not familiar, and for those of you who have been on my show on the 3 weeks I've had it, I'm not familiar and I don't subscribe to really Treasury account set-offs. I believe this is what I believe in.
No,
I can be
a good.
I understand. I understand. Whatever method you use, I'm not familiar with that because if it's not something that I can read in law, if it's not something that I can go to court and win, brother, I really don't have any enforcement. What I do is make my money suing debt collectors, okay, whoever they may be. And what I use is the law and the court's going
to.
Sure.
I think I got one on the rope. It was a lawyer pretending to be it was a debt collector. Here in New York, there was a law passed where lawyers or attorneys parading at a debt collector, they have to verify the debt first.
Right.
Okay. It's my understanding that this mortgage was supposed to have been bought, or the bank was bought by another bank. So now you got a servicer that comes in, and now the servicer, like you were just saying, is saying that they want to foreclose on you. That's a no-no, correct?
A servicer can't foreclose on you, no. A servicer is not able to foreclose on you at all. A servicer is only able to collect payments, send out payments, handle assurance issues, handle your questions, do things of that nature, but they're very limited in their authority. They can act on behalf of the lender, but your lender, your creditor, is the only one that can make power moves, who can confiscate your property or issue a notice of default or issue a power of sale or things of that nature. That particular correspondence has to come from the creditor.
Right. Well, that didn't happen. First, they sent down some attorneys as debt collectors. They sent something like for foreclosure, went to the court because I wanted to get a deuces. You know, I wanted to prepare myself. First of all, I sent them a negative vermin, an affidavit of negative vermin, you know, to respond to the foreclosure notice. And I went to the court to get a, you know, subpoena deuces tecum, to subpoena certain documents for them to verify, you know, this debt. Come to find out there's nothing on the books. It's a ghost. They did something electronically. They have nothing in the county court on the record of this case with that index number. So I notified them and so forth. And then they sent me a stipulation to discontinue the attorneys.
Okay.
And, you know, they wanted to just walk away, eat each other's cost, and just walk away.
I think you were on weren't you on a call this week and you told Yousef that story?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I'm glad you called back in because it was one of the questions I was trying to get in with Yousef to jump in on your particular questions, and I'm glad you regurgitated that question. Yeah, so when you catch these debt collectors, and you will catch them, if you learn anything Brother Sharif teaches you, you will catch them almost every time because there is not one debt collector in this country that does not violate the FDCPA when they're attempting to collect the debt from you, and most of the time it's going to be the attorneys, okay? But I heard you tell that story to where whatever kind of offense or defense you proffered to them, you kind of had them on the ropes like Mayweather would. And they kind of said, okay, well, how about we walk away, you walk away. But no, see, I don't subscribe to that. If I got a burglar breaking in my house and he's got one foot in the window,
I agree.
He's ain't going
to
be like, all right, man, you caught me with one leg in the window, man. I ain't getting all the way in there,
that's
man.
Right.
Or you caught me with the window open. Now, brother, you getting laid out. Okay, you getting wet up the same way you would if you were all the way in the house. So when you had them on the ropes like that, you should have filed you a counterclaim, or you should have said, look, brother, you got to pay for the attempt of the theft. You understand what I mean? Just because I caught you, now you want to walk away and do a stipulation agreement that, look, you won't sue me, you'll waive all, you know, rights to bring suit later, and we walk away and you walk away. Nah, bro. See, I had to come in here. I had to utilize my time. I had to get on Google. I had to go to the law library. I had to draft documents. I had to drive here. I'm nervous. I got an intentional emotional infliction of stress. I couldn't talk to my kids because I was worried about this case tomorrow. I had to be up all night. I mean, me and my wife ain't really got down a lot because she thinking I'm about to lose something. You see what I mean? Those are emotional damages, man. You should have went on the offense.
Let
me tell you what you should have done, and I'll let you go. You should have said, how are you guys going to compensate me for these violations? The stipulation agreement is not going to be that you walk away and I walk away. No, brother, I got to be compensated. So how are you going to compensate me? And that should have been your talk. And you probably could have did that, brother, without any court action because they understand the deal. Go ahead. Lay me out.
I responded to their offer to discontinue. I rebutted it and showed the inaccuracy because she said I never responded. You know, and her stipulation, nobody responded, this and that.
Okay.
You know, nothing was done, no damage. I mean, no, I did respond. Third parties also. In any event, I gave him a counteroffer. I said, no, I have been damaged. Matter of fact, my collective entities have been damaged. and I made him a counter offer for $30K. I haven't heard from him in 45 days, so I was interested in putting a letter together, to remind him, and thank you for accepting my offer, because it sounds like acquiescence to me, and some of those things you just said.
Right. Well, and yeah, and that is the exact story that you had told Brother Yusuf. Let me say this, and that question, that answer that I provided was from your question that you asked. And you asked Yusuf, I believe, I sent them a letter, and they haven't responded in 30 days. You're not going to get a court to enforce silence as being a liability for some damages, okay? You may be able to utilize that within your pleadings and say, you know, I sent them this particular correspondence, this communication. They didn't respond in 30 days. I asked them to respond to my offer. Now, if you give someone an offer, like a debt collector does you, and send a dunning letter, and they say, you know, respond to the debt or dispute within 30 days, you can do the same thing. Say, listen, you know, based on your attempt to collect this debt that I didn't know existed, or I have no evidence deeming it a debt, this is my offer to you, and you need to respond to such offer within 30 days. $30,000 I feel is a little bit too high. I think if you would have kept it reasonable, okay, then they would have said okay, or you would have begun the negotiation process. And they'll negotiate.
How much are we going to cost them to go to court?
It all depends on how you went after them. If you took them in small claims court, not much. If you took them in state
court,
probably a little bit more.
I'm trying to cure amicably. I'm trying to avoid court. That was a
$30,000. It's not going to cost them $30,000. You're just shooting too high. We got to be realistic.
I'm looking for tort damages. If I go to court, I'm going for tort
damages.
So it's going to be in trouble. So it's going
to
cost them.
Well, let me tell you what you're going to face if you went to court. So you're going for tort damages, stress, abuse of process, malicious prosecution, defamation, things of that nature. Will you get $30,000? Possibly, but you're going to have to litigate that all the way to the end and possibly deal with an appeal and then get your $30,000 if all levels of court, the lower court and upper court, appellate court, and if they go any further, agrees with you. So are you going to still stick to the $30,000, or are you going to say, listen, for the amount of time I had to spend, for the little stress that I went through for the disagreement, I think you should pay me about $10,000, $5,000 for my time, and then I'll go away and won't sue you. If you keep it realistic, brother, you'll get something. If you go for $30,000, if you ask me for $30,000, I'm going to make you earn it. I don't care if I'm wrong or not. I'm going to take my chances taking you to court, and hopefully I can find one of those due process procedures that you violated and hopefully get your case kicked out. But I'm going to try you on for $30,000, bro. I don't care how wrong I am. I'm going to try you on and try to keep it up in the air in court. But you're talking about a lawyer, though, so you know that's how he's thinking. $30,000? This dude crazy. He has like, boy, we're going to go to the Supreme Court for $30,000. Let's see if you can get there. I'm sorry?
Are an attorney's public offices?
Yes, they are.
So don't they have more to lose by violating me?
Not on consumer protection laws, no. Again, they pay pennies for the debt, brother. They pay pennies for the debt, so, you know,
I'm talking about them. I got names. They hurt me. They damaged me in my household and my name.
Okay, defamation. Then, yeah, but the court is going to look at it and say, okay, well, how much defamation? They filed a small claim suit against you. Really, it's not what wasn't put into the newspaper. It wasn't
publicated. They sent letters to, I'm in a condominium. They sent letters to people saying that I'm a debtor and this and that. They damaged me.
Sure. Okay, yeah, you got defamation. But if it's worth $30,000, brother, what I'm telling you is that you're going to have to prove your case in court. They're not going to write you a check for $30,000. You see what I'm saying?
Well, that's
all I'm
saying.
I'm not saying that, brother. I can't say that you don't have $30,000 worth of damages. Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying you don't have $30,000 worth of damages. What I'm saying is you're going to have to do a pretty damn good Easter speech in front of the church to get that money, okay? You're going to have to go to the court, prove your case. You're going to have some patches out your hair. You're going to have your wife show up there and be deposed and say, yep, he ain't touched me in about 2 weeks, and this dude is active, okay? So, yeah, you follow what I mean? We got some damages here. This brother is active. He ain't touched me in a month. That's some damages for me, okay, because I need that. So I'm not saying you don't earn it, brother.
That's right.
So, you know, just be reasonable, man. The good thing you did is that you got rid of the debt. They're not going to come after you if you went after them like that. And that stipulation agreement, you got rid of the debt. So you cleaned up your credit. You got that off your credit.
For, the so-called bank or creditor, they're sending me notices. And on their notice, it says there's an attempt to collect the debt. What does that tell
you? All right. Then, brother, you're going to have endless opportunities because all they're going to do is regurgitate these debts and circulate them from one company to another. That's why tell people why I do a bankruptcy. Why do a bankruptcy? Just go after each debt collector and turn that debt into money. No, I was just making that mention because I had mentioned that in my preceding segment talking about bankruptcy and people filing those. Yeah.
Why would I even want to do a bankruptcy?
That's right. Exactly. But not everybody thinks like you. Yeah, I would sue them, man, and I would take them to court and try them on. All right, brother? I would definitely take them to court. I would send them another notice and maybe I was a little bit too high in my damages. Okay, and what did they say?
They just got it, like yesterday.
Okay.
So I'm waiting here for
them. See if
I had it a postile, huh?
Yeah, let's see if they come to the table, man. Okay.
It was a cease and desist, you know. Like, I don't owe you nothing. You haven't proved it. And plus, I offset the debt, you know. I gave them a proper vessel. Well, you don't know about that. But anyway, right. They know. And they haven't sent it back. So they're not following the law.
All right. But I'm going to tell you, brother.
But they're debt collectors.
Right, and I want to tell you this, and I'll close out. Don't get excited when they don't answer. You're not going to get any debt collector or any violator of law to sit up there and admit and say, okay, yeah, man, you're right. You know, I hit you with 30 grand in damages. Yeah, you're right, I'm wrong. Yeah, I violated the law. That's not going to happen. You wouldn't get that from me. I don't care how guilty I am. I know. So let's keep negotiating with them, man. Just bring them to the table. Give them a number that's going to bring them to the table. And when they start counteroffering you, man, well, not 5 grand. We feel like you probably deserve probably 30, you know, $3,000. And I think 4 grand, man, we'll call it the day. And just keep negotiating with them until you come to a number. And look, they got deeper pockets in New York. You understand? They got deeper pockets in New York. I'm from New York.
All right,
I know.
Somebody get over, bro. Good talk.
Okay, brother. Appreciate you, man. Good luck. All right. All right. We're going to go down to Georgia. 678-5157. 678-5157. You're on High Frequency Radio. What's your question, comment, or concern?
Yes. Greeting, Brother Sharif.
Greetings.
And thank you very much for all of the free, wonderful information that you're providing for us. You are much appreciated.
Thank you, Queen. Thank you, Mother.
I would like to hopefully gain some clarity, and I would like to reference back to 1692I.
Yes, ma'am.
Where it's stating that in the case of an action to enforce an interest in real property, that the action can only be taken in a judicial district or similar legal entity. And I was hoping you could give me some clarification on exactly what is a judicial district. And then also going to section lowercase b, it states that nothing in this title shall be construed to authorize the bringing of legal actions by debt collectors. So does not that one statement pretty much negate all of the legal actions that a debt collector can take?
Great. That's a great question, sister and mother, and I'll try to address that for you and clarify it for you. 1692I, which is legal actions by debt collectors, deals with actions regarding real property. And what it says is that any debt collector who brings any legal action on a debt. Now, understand that they didn't say mortgage. They didn't say security deed. They didn't say deed of trust. They didn't use any of that language. They said any action on a debt against a consumer shall, okay, shall, must. In the case of an action to enforce an interest in real property, securing the consumer's obligation, which would pertain to a mortgage deed of trust, a security deed, or any other instrument, okay, brings such action only in a judicial district. That means in a judicial branch district, whatever court. Some courts have, like in New York, you have your state court is called the Supreme Court, although it's not the Supreme Court of the state. So it will be whatever judicial district equivalent or that has jurisdiction to hear such matters, which will usually be your small claims court, okay, or your state court, okay, that's going to be the judicial district or similar, your federal court, okay, so just the district, it's a judicial district meaning a specific area, okay, where they must bring that action, or similar legal entity, whatever legal venue is available in your particular court, in your particular state, they must bring that action in which such real property is located. So that means they have to bring, if you're domiciling in New Jersey and you own property in Georgia, they have to sue you, okay, where you reside, which when you go further down, you'll see in A and B. They have to bring that action where you reside or where the property is located, wherever you are staying, wherever you are inhabiting, wherever you are residing. They have to bring that action, okay? Or they have to bring that action in the state where you signed the contract, okay? So say they can't find you. Say the property's in Georgia, but they know you're living in New York, then they got to bring it in New York, okay? Wherever they can find you and serve you, wherever the contract was signed or wherever you're residing or wherever the property is, okay? So if you're in Russia, you know, and you're living in Russia and you own property there, then it's more than likely they got to serve you in Russia and probably sue you in Russia. I'm being facetious, but it has to be where you're residing, where you signed the contract, or where the property lies, is situated. Okay. Now, when you get down to B, when it says nothing in this title shall be construed to authorize the bringing of legal actions by debt collectors, that's just merely saying that the law is not telling you you can sue for real property. A debt collector can sue for real property. It's not telling you this is what you have to do, and it's not telling you this is what you need to do. So that's, it's just saying we're just telling you if you're going to do this and you have the authority to do so, then this is how you have to do it. But we're not telling you that this is what you can do. That's why it says nothing in this title shall be construed to authorize the bringing of legal actions by debt collectors. So we're not saying a debt collector can do it, okay? That's what that's saying. We're just saying if you were to do it, if you want to try a consumer on and you get a consumer that knows the business, you're going to get the business. Okay, even if you do it, although the law allows for you to do it, if you bring it and you bring it wrong, then you have to face the liabilities in 1692K. Did that answer your question regarding B?
Yes, I think it did. Thank you so very much.
Okay. Now, and when you're dealing with that, sister, just understand that, you know, you need to mention that in your communication with the debt collectors. It says that you're making a threat. Okay, and read the FDCPA. You're making a threat that you're going to take property using a non-judicial process if you're in a non-judicial state. But let me point out, you know, 1692I says that you really can't do that. You're forbidden from bringing a non-judicial action because you're a debt collector, okay? You're a debt collector under 1692A6, and I'm a consumer under 1692A3, and you're not a creditor under 1692A4, and you're collecting a debt under 1692A5. So what did I tell them? This is your lane right here, the FDCPA, and these are the laws that govern you, and this is what the law says. I don't care if you're collecting a debt, a monkey, a frog, a chicken, you're on a farm, I don't care where you are. In order for you to pursue any type of claim of a debt, you have to be governed by the FDCPA because you obtained this alleged loan while it was in default. You have to do it judicially, and the court has to monitor how you do it, which is why they're saying you got to come to the court in order to do that because you're a debt collector, and the court knows that debt collectors have very limited authority when they're collecting, and they have to do it a very specific way.
All right.
Does that address you, Mother?
Yes, excellent, excellent. Thank you.
Thank you so much. All right. We're going to go to the next caller here. Let's go down to 267-3782. 267-3782. You are on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question, comment, or concern? 3782? I'm sorry. Let me open up your line. 3782, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Greetings, greetings. Welcome to High Frequency Radio. Do you have? Yes, I can hear you.
Okay. Yes.
You are
on
the air. What's your question? Good afternoon.
My question is, good afternoon. My question is in reference to sure sales for, let's say, non-payment of taxes. How does that whole scenario work? And does he really have the authority to put people out of their homes because of back taxes or whatever, alleged back taxes?
Well, you know, taxes are a form of debt collection. That is not really my expertise, but I will say that taxes is something that, yes, the sheriff is allowed. If you're asking me if the sheriff is allowed to sell your property for payment of taxes, yes, but it all depends. You know, tax sales are a big revenue source. Tax sales goes to fundings of your schools, goes to funding of your different municipalities, and your roadways, your sanitation, a variety of things. So, you know, there's always several legs to this mortgage foreclosure debacle, is that it cripples a lot of counties and states because they're not receiving those revenues from sales taxes, from property taxes. So what they'll do is that even I or you can go back buy tax certificates, all right? And those tax certificates is, let's say you're in default of $5,000 in taxes, the county will do a tax sale, okay? And I can buy and pay for your taxes, okay, and you would have to pay me back interest and fees and whatnot for doing so. And if you don't in a certain amount of time, I can acquire your property for the cost of your taxes. But what it does for the county is that it pays them the $5,000 so they can go ahead and, you know, go ahead and fund their schools or their roads or whatever they want to do. So they'll do that almost, you know, they won't blink in order to do that. But if it was bought, that tax certificate was bought by another party, then that party, in essence, becomes a debt collector. If you have any dispute towards the taxes, that dispute would have to be taken up with the county. So taxes gets a little bit tricky. What I would suggest is that you understand or research whether you are a taxpayer and whether you are subject to, by doing some land research, okay, and land title search, to determine whether you should even be paying property tax. And I'll go and tell you that most of the time, property tax are not legal, okay? You don't pay property tax just because you buy a property. You don't pay taxes on it forever. You pay the tax when you purchase the property. Okay, taxes is a big revenue generator for our country, not just our states, our country. And many of these taxes are coming to light to be found that, you know, we're not even supposed to be taxed for these, for most of the taxes we inherit. So I suggest you research that. But, yes, it's a very difficult thing. It's something that the county is not going to blink their eye on doing, but it's something that you have to mount a defense. You have to do your land title search, because I've read information out there, and I haven't really become a perfected student of this information, but I heard that with the transitioning of land from the early years, that most taxes were waived by land title on the land and the property, and we shouldn't be paying such taxes. But also, you have to understand that within your deed of trust and within your mortgage, it is considered a corporate transaction, and many times you are considered a corporation. So a corporation can be taxed, okay, which is how they treat us as individuals and persons, which is the way they define taxpayers. Those are considered corporate entities. So corporate entities can be taxed. If you're not a corporate entity, then how is your property being taxed just by mere ownership of your land and your property? So I hope, okay, hopefully, you know, that would take a little bit more indulging on that issue. But I would say that if someone bought a tax certificate on your property because you failed to pay your taxes, then that person who bought that tax certificate would be a debt collector, because they're not sure that you owe the taxes. They just bought the certificate based on taking the information that the county said. Well, if you determine that the county was in error in billing you for taxes, which more than likely they are, then that debt collector who purchased that certificate doesn't really have much of a standing to be able to take your property. But again, that is a big undertaking where you're going to be, you know, going up against the state or county, and that's going to be something that I don't know if you're resolved soon enough. I would just say in most counties and states, you know, they afford you payment plans. That's why, you know, when I speak to a lot of clients, you know, I determine, okay, you have a foreclosure issue, but most people that have a foreclosure issue almost always have a tax issue. So let's say we get rid of the foreclosure issue, you still can lose your house to the tax issue because you didn't pay. So one thing I always tell people is always pay your taxes and pay your insurance, because you don't want your house to burn down and you be without a home. Okay, and you don't want to sustain damages from weather related or fire or anything, and you not be covered in your belongings. Okay, and you don't want to deal with the tax issue and a foreclosure issue at the same time. So you have to choose your battles, and I would always say until you gain the knowledge, the requisite knowledge that you need to pursue the tax issue, at least pay your taxes or make some payment arrangements so you don't have that leg fall, even if you're successful at getting rid of your mortgage issue.
Right, right. The only other question I have for you in reference to being a pro se litigant versus improper persona. Tell me your take on that being different.
Many people say it matters. It may matter if you're in a criminal matter as opposed to a civil matter, but because I deal with this show and I deal with more debt foreclosure-related issues, I don't care what you call me. I'm coming into court to get some money. I got a debt collector that's violated several provisions of consumer protection laws, and you can call me McGill or Gorilla. I just want my money. Okay, so I really don't pay attention to those terminologies. If you're a defendant, then and you're in pro se, you're defending a debt collector, it doesn't matter whether you say you're in impropria persona or you're pro se. It doesn't matter. Your defenses is going to be the same. But I think what you're thinking about, if you're in a criminal matter, it may have some bearing on that title. Or if they're naming you defendant, you need to reject that particular title, because you're not a defendant until you've been found liable for some violation of law. Right now, you're just the accused. But let's not, I don't get hung up on titles and things of that nature, specifically or germane to the debt collection arena. I don't care what they call me, because I'm going to prevail at every turn, because I know, you can call me whatever you want. I'm coming after you to get this money, and I just want a check, and you can call me whatever you want afterwards.
And this is definitely the last question. The brother that was on with you last Tuesday, who has a talk show or has some kind of show every Sunday, is that a blog talk show that he has every Sunday or some other kind of show?
It is a blog talk, and it's Fix Your Mortgage Mess. And you
can just Google that.
It's Latif Kareem Bey, and he's a very good friend, partner, constituent of mine, and he offers very, very, very good information on mortgage and foreclosure related things. I am usually a guest on that show quite frequently, but now since I'm on my own show here, probably won't be on there as much, but he deals with a lot of information regarding mortgages. But again, most of the people that's on this call, even yourself, you usually don't know that you really don't have a mortgage issue. You have a debt collection issue. So I don't get lost, because those cases and information regarding mortgages and deeds and TILA and RESPA and all these other thousands of laws and cases that go along with it can be quite inundating and it can be quite confusing. What I narrow down to is, who are you? Are you a debt collector or are you a mortgagee? Are you a lender or are you a pretender lender? Are you a creditor or are you a debt collector? I stay in that one lane, because that one lane is going to take care of all that other language, because I'm not going to allow you. You're going to find your debt collectors is going to try to act as if they are creditors and mortgagees, and they can do assignments and they can do all that. I don't even follow that stuff. And he said, well, we did an assignment, and it's a robo-signer on the assignment, and you can't. We start arguing subject matter a mortgagee or a creditor can take. And when you argue that, you're always going to run into problems, because it's an argument to whether a creditor or a lender can do certain things. And you're going to lose that, because most times creditors and lenders can do those things. But what your argument should be is that I understand that creditors and lenders and mortgagees can do certain things. And I understand that it's going to be subjective and it's up to the court to determine whether they did it right. But the court don't give a damn whether they did it right or not if they're a creditor, a mortgagee, or a lender. What my argument is that documentation that you proffered to me or that you offered, that you deferred to the court, does not apply to you, because you're a damn debt collector. You can't issue assignments. You can't do creditor-related functions. You can't behave as a creditor. You can't send me a bank statement. You can't tell me that, you know, you're servicing a loan. You're not servicing nothing. You're a debt collector. You have a defaulted debt, allegedly, and you have a debt that you can't prove. And what I'm telling you is that I deny and object to any letters that you send me, and I need you to verify, one, who you are, and verify the alleged debt that you report to be acting for. And I'm telling you right now, it's nothing you can send me to verify that because you have no firsthand knowledge of anything. The only thing you have is some documents, and if we don't deny the authenticity of those documents, then that's where we run into a problem. I do not recall having a mortgage. You need to send me some evidence, admissible evidence. Don't cut and paste some documents. Don't send me assignments. That assignment means nothing to me. I understand you want me to think that you're a creditor that is able to do these things, and creditors are. I'm not arguing that. What I'm saying is that you, a debt collector, can't send those kind of documents because you're not a creditor.
Yes,
okay,
yes,
but that's fix your mortgage mess. He's
on
mess, Sunday.
Fix your mortgage mess. Do you
fix
know
your mortgage
number?
Mess? I don't. But if you just Google it, Mother, it would be on there, and you'll be able to get on his show. It's from 7 to 9 every Sunday.
All right, thank you so much for your time.
You are so much. I hope that helps. Not
right,
a problem.
Peace.
All right, peace. All right, we're going to go to the next caller, 469-6123, 469-6123. You are on High Frequency Radio. What's your question, comment, or concern? 6123. All right. We're going to go to the next caller here. 26. I think we went to them already. Let's go to 615-1652. 615-1652. You are on High Frequency Radio. Turn your radio down in the background. And let me have your question, comment, or concern.
Hello, hello.
Hello.
Hello, Sheree, what's going on? This
hey, brother, how you feel?
From the Tennessee Territory. And,
all right,
brother. I just wanted to give some thought on. I listened to one of your previous calls where you talked about the county affidavit with the forcible detainer. And so I'm in Tennessee, so I was looking to see if I could find something similar within the Tennessee codes. And what I found was a particular rule on sureties on bonds, actions to protect interest, and it's the rule for the principal, upon notice given, the court shall make a rule requiring the principal within the given time to give such counter security, and on failure of the principal to comply with the rule, the court shall dismiss the suit and give judgment against the principal and the principal's surety for the cost already accrued. So I was wondering if that could be a potential avenue for, you know, some of the people maybe in Tennessee and some of the other areas that do not quite have that kind of affidavit terminology that's listed in Georgia. And I know this could be potentially from a secured party creditor status or anything like that. So I just wanted to throw that out there and see what you thought about that.
Okay. It sounds like a good law. Did you find that in your state laws, and is it regarding an eviction or is it regarding foreclosure of property?
It's a special proceeding, and the forcible detainer is under those special proceedings. And
okay.
A lot of times, I know Brother Yusuf always says, you know, make sure you put that bond into the case. And I know you got to come from a particular status in order to do that. So I don't want to confuse anything, or you know, this may take a separate private email or something to discuss the theory. So I was just, you know, throwing that out there for, you know, if provided a bond into the case, and you know, when they bring that forcible detainer, that they don't provide any bond associated to the case. So if we provide the bond, then they have to provide a counter security. And if they don't do so, then that forcible detainer should be dismissed pursuant to this rule.
Right. My opinion on that, brother, is that, you know, when you're dealing with it all depends on what type of forcible detainer issue you're facing, because there are some legitimate forcible detainers. There are some people that have landlord-tenant agreements and they violate or don't pay the rent or breach some element of that contract, and you do, and a landlord does, or principal, a landlord would be a principal, does have judicial authority to go ahead and act on his contract. So what it sounds like is that if something is erroneous about that proceeding or something is erroneous about the particular case in itself, then it sounds like that principal must bond that particular or indemnify the court in case there's some damages that's been levied upon you. So, you know, to tie that into some foreclosure action, let's say they did a non-judicial foreclosure, which you have no control of. You can't stop, you know, Billy Bob Law Firm from doing an illegal foreclosure, okay? You can't stop them. They're going to do that without the purview of the court. So let's say they did that and they did it erroneously and went to evict you and you brought up some defenses that pertain to the issue of title or that wrongful foreclosure was conducted, then it sounds like if you appeal that particular a matter or if you brought up certain defenses that the court deemed that maybe the principal was erroneously before the court or not properly before the court, then it sounds like that special action gives you the ability to challenge certain things, and if the court sees fit for them to levy some sort of a bond or surety to protect you and indemnify the court yourself against any damages because they brought the action wrongfully. So, yeah, that's something that I think you should share with the Tennessee people.
You know, if you give me the law, I'll put it out there on the air for those that might be situated in Tennessee.
Okay, it's Tennessee Code.
What is the name of the code?
Tennessee Code annotated
29-33-102. So for those of you in Tennessee, you know, go ahead and research Tennessee Code 29-33-102, and that sort of, at least it sounds like it gives some sort of relief for wrongful actions brought by a principal and mandates that the principal provide some sort of surety. Now, with regards to your question, respect to your question about, you know, USEF and the creditors and bonds, that is something entirely, not entirely different, but definitely different than the avenue that I'm on. And I know, Brother, it's quite difficult with all of the variety of information that Brother Savage and Brother Youssef gives, and then you tie in myself, and I'm on the avenue, and it seems like we're mirroring each other, but, man, we're on different planes, different jets, you know, and
know,
we're going to
different,
and it's hard not to mix them, okay? So when you're dealing with bonds, would you hear me talk about, I don't deal with bonds, I deal with straight debt collection, straight foreclosure. I don't deal with any other issues. I don't have to indemnify the judge. I don't have to ask him, does he have an Oval Office? I really don't give a damn what he got. Do you have the ability to sign an order that's going to get me some money? Because I'm going to put before you some damages and liabilities, and all I want you to do, Judge, I don't care if you were on a golf course all week. You're going to read my pleadings. You're going to listen to my testimony at the hearing, and you're determined that this debt collector injured me, and you're just going to write me an order that I'm able to take and deposit into my bank account once the debt collector pays me for the damages. That's it, brother. That's me.
That's right.
No processes.
That's right.
No bonds. No, I don't care if the judge don't have a goddamn oath. I really don't give a damn.
Right.
As long as he can hear and he applies the law appropriately, okay, then the facts is the only thing I'm going to have him determine. Not hearsay, just the facts. Judge, would you agree that hearsay is not allowed in this court today? Yes. So do you agree that based on the story and based on my pleadings, that I'm the only one that can offer facts here today? Do you understand I'm willing to testify as to those facts, and the plaintiff or the defendant is not willing to do so or is not able to do so? Okay, so therefore my testimony stands on the record. If not countered, okay, it stands as fact. Okay, and that's it.
Right.
That's all I discussed. I just want my money. This is what they did to me. This is what these are the letters that they sent. This is what they said. They conducted a wrongful foreclosure. They didn't have the authority or the ability to do so. I don't know who they are. I sent them a dispute letter, certified mail, FedEx by this time. Okay, that communication is enumerated by this tracking number. Okay, that tracking number shows that, you know, Mary at the front desk signed for this debt collection letter or this letter of dispute or the communications on this particular day at this time. Receipt has been provided and exhibited as Exhibit A. You see what I mean? I'm just laying down the facts. I'm not talking about the mortgage. I'm not even mentioning a mortgage because I no longer have a mortgage. I don't, and most of you don't. Y'all don't have a mortgage, man. Y'all think y'all have a mortgage. Your guilt and your conscience continues to be the driving force behind these debt collectors being successful doing a Halloween trick on you acting like they're lenders because we're not identifying them appropriately, although they give sometimes vague but enough indication that they are because they put the mini Miranda on the bottom and say this is an attempt to collect the debt. Whenever you see that, okay, look on your power bills or your cable bills. Do you ever see on a statement this is an attempt to collect the debt? No, because they're creditors. And they're sending you a statement. Nah, bro, I got a debt with you, but I'm not considered a debt collector. I'm giving you cable service. So I don't have to identify myself as a debt collector. You're getting that line to your house. You're watching CNN or MSNBC or HBO, right? Right. I'm not a debt collector, dude. I'm the one that's putting the juice to that socket so you're able to get cable. So what I'm telling you is that when they put there that they're a debt collector, then that is your trigger. Oh, Brother Sharif should be the first thing comes to your mind. This is a debt collector. Let me look in 15 U.S.C. 1692, and let me look at 1681, the Fair Credit Reporting Act. Let me see if these jokers that sent me this letter is reporting anything derogatory to my credit. And let me look at my consumer protection laws and see what else I can put against them, and I'm going to send them a letter that's collective and combined with all three of those laws and say, listen, if you don't correct your actions or if you reported any erroneous information or if you don't validate this debt on time, I'm going to sue you under these three provisions, FDCPA, FCRA, TCPA, okay, and my consumer protection laws. And you send them a letter, one letter, brother, I'm just telling you, one letter, you can get rid of these debt collectors. With a mortgage, $200,000 mortgage, you're going to fight a little bit more. Again, they're going to make you earn it. As I told the brother that was on the phone before, if you want to ask a debt collector for $30,000, it's more than likely going to be within a court setting, okay, because they're not going to write your check for $30,000 without you earning it. Okay, you're going to have to plead your ass off, all right, and show the court that you need to be awarded $30,000. So keep it realistic. But on a mortgage issue, you're going to have to do a little bit more than send them some letters. You're going to actually have to sue them. Or if you have the luxury of being in a judicial state, once they sue you, you should have a ball at defending that and turning that around with a counterclaim and suing them for damages for even bringing the action. Did that answer your question, brother?
Absolutely, brother. Appreciate everything you do.
Thank you, man. Peace and love to you, and I hope it helps. Thank you. All right. Let's see where we're going to go back. Let me fluctuate here. Let's go to 410. I think I went there already. Let's go to 469. I think I went there already. Let's go to Anonymous. Got Anonymous call here. Anonymous, I have no phone number for you, but welcome to High Frequency Radio. You can turn your computer down or your radio down, whatever instrument you're using to listen to the call, and answer your question. Anonymous, do you have a question? All right. Well, Anonymous wanted to remain anonymous. All right. Let's go to 240-2666, 240 phone number ending in 2666. You're on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question,
hey, good
comment?
Evening. Good evening, brother. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm well. I was just listening, and I heard you saying that, you know, that you didn't have a mortgage. How do you go by clearing that deal up? If that's the case, because I have a family member, we're trying to get, well, put like this, my mother, I'm trying to clear her mortgage up or get her to be able to write these bills of exchange and stuff like that. How would I go about doing that?
Okay. Bills of exchange and commercial processes such as those, I can't admit or deny that those particular procedures work. I am not a student of that. Brother Youssef, maybe Brother Savage, or other gurus in that particular arena may be able to offer you or shed some light in that particular theory, but I'm not a fan of that. I don't do it because I'm always going to find enough violations with any creditor even, okay, because you got to understand creditors can violate the FDCPA as well. But I find enough violations in their behavior because they're very sloppy in what they do. I don't care if you have a legitimate mortgage or not. But I don't utilize those processes because those processes – sometimes don't work and they convolute and clog up the pipe for really good perceivable and valid violations that they commit.
So I don't try to, you know, muddy up the record by sending in something that they might not be familiar with or something that's going to cause my legitimate remedy not to be taken seriously. So what I do is find violations in their communications, five violations in their demands, and I sue them under some law that I know that I can go into a court of competent jurisdiction, put my finger on that law, put my finger on that violation, and hold them liable for the damages that they caused because of it. So when you know you don't have a legitimate mortgage, is if you have an assignment while it's in default, whether you have some indication that the loan was sold into the secondary market via securitization. Okay, those are pretty much indications that, you know, your mortgage, one, was already paid, satisfied, okay? And if you look in, if you're in a deed of trust state, you will look in section 22.
On the deed of trust?
On the deed of trust.
Okay.
All right. And you will look. You will start usually at section. Let me make sure. Section 22, which is going to be under the title Non-Uniform Covenants. There, it would explain to you the procedure that a lender, okay, must take to accelerate a loan for a breach, meaning you didn't pay a payment. All right, so it'll cover under 22, it'll cover acceleration. But if you also, and if you got a standard, you know, Fannie Mae deed of trust, draft a deed of trust, then usually the sections will be the same. Well, if not, just fine within there under default provisions. And what you will have is you'll have reconveyance under 23 of that sections. And it says once payment of all sums secured by the security instrument, lender shall request trustee to reconvey the property and to surrender the security instrument and all notes evidencing the debt secured by the security instrument to the trustee. What's important is that it says that once that is paid, and it doesn't say who pays it, okay, once they've received payment, so if your loan has been sold into the secondary market, it's been paid. Okay, so they must send you a satisfaction of that mortgage. So what I'm saying is that by operation of law, that deed is now extinguished. It's done. Or if it was sold to the secondary market, credit default swap insurance paid it, or any other of the insurances that these banks have. They have multiple on these loans. So what I'm saying is it ceased to exist as a mortgage. It transitions once you are in default. It transitions to a debt. Okay, and now they're collecting on a debt, depending on how your loan was assigned or transferred and things of that nature. So that's how you'll have to determine whether you have a legitimate mortgage. Forget the note. I really don't care about, you know, show me the note and the promise. Just show me the money. Show me where you, you know, XYZ, you know, lender loaned me money. Don't show me paperwork because that's not necessarily admissible evidence. It's not self-authenticating. You know, there's a procedure and process they must do to introduce those publicly filed documents, okay? Just because it's in the public record doesn't mean it's accurate, it's true, or it has validity. We all know many counties and states are suing MERS and suing the banks for the horrible state of their county recording system, that they can't rely upon the county recording system, which has been around for hundreds of years, as far as determining who has title. And this was all done by design because they wanted the county recorder to not be a viable option to determine ownership. Now, do you have to rely upon MERS? So MERS was designed by the banks to give the county recording system hell and have the county recording system rely upon another system that they own and they run, which is MERS. But understand that people, I want to say this, and speaking of MERS, and I don't go into those issues because, like I said, I believe, and through my research and knowledge and experience, most of us are not dealing with mortgagees. So when you deal, I want to say this about MERS, is understand that MERS, Mortgage Electronic Registration System, is who's listed in your mortgage, your deed of trust, most of the time, okay? But what we have to understand that MERS, Mortgage Electronic Registration Systems, is no longer around. They're dead.
What?
They're now called MERS Corp. This is why you have to understand the name shell game, the name musical chairs that they play.
you have to look in Delaware, the county recorder, and look and see there's been four name changes to MERS. They've changed the MERS Inc. They've changed the MERS Corp. They've changed the mortgage registration systems, okay? So you have to know, and I'm not going to explain it all to you because I don't want people right. running in there, because you run to the court and you start talking about MERS and you start justifying or you start sanctioning the fact that, yeah, they're a mortgager. Okay, I'm not talking about that, but I just want you to know, if you have these MERS assignments, how can MERS, who's no longer MERS, MERS doesn't exist. Mortgage Electronic Registration System does not exist. You need to go ahead and get on Google and tell and let Brother Free tell you that you need to do your research. MERS Corp is around, okay, but Mortgage Electronic Registration System, they've been gone since 1995.
Wow.
Okay, and 1998 changed to MERS Corp. So you got MERS assignments, an entity that's been died, but they're still doing assignments, and people are not catching that. And if you don't catch it, the court can't catch it for you, okay? They can't right. defend your action. They can only referee call balls and strikes, okay? If you don't object and be like, I don't know, MERS, they've been out of business. Oh, is MERS still in business? I mean, as far as I know, MERS Corp is around. So if MERS Corp, okay, if MERS Corp is a separate entity, and if you look, they'll tell you that. They'll tell you that MERS is a separate entity than the lender. Okay? It's a subsidiary of MERS Corp. But if they're not around anymore, what are they the subsidiary of?
Right.
All right? So we need to be conscious and cognizant of that with regards to that. But again, I don't pay attention to those issues. And they'll be like, well, we did a MERS assignment. They'll be like, Judge, I'm really not going to spend a whole lot of time and waste judicial resources on fighting about MERS, because I know we can do this all day and I wind up losing on a technicality because I don't know how many entities MERS own and how many subsidiaries. What I'm saying right. simply is that they're a debt collector and they can't utilize the functions of a creditor. And the functions okay. of a creditor is using a MERS assignment, is it not? So then they can't do that. Okay, so when you look on your mortgage, you'll see Mortgage Electronic Registration System is named on your mortgage as the mortgagee in a nominee capacity. Okay, so it tells you MERS is a company separate from your lender that operates an electronic tracking system for mortgage rights. MERS is not your lender. It is a company that provides an alternative means of registering the mortgage lien in the public records. Okay, MERS maintains a database of all loans registered with it, including the name of the lender on each loan. Your lender has elected to name MERS as the mortgagee in a nominee capacity and record the mortgage in the public land records to protect its lien rights for your property. Naming MERS as the mortgagee and registering the mortgage on the MERS electronic tracking system does not affect your obligation to your lender under the promissory note. Understand that the promissory note never lists MERS. Okay? Understand that there's two elements to a consumer transaction involving real estate. There's a mortgage and there's a note. If you don't have the note, okay, you don't have anything. You can't assign the note without – you can't assign the mortgage without the note, okay? Period. Okay, so the note holder is the most powerful entity. The note holder has a cash equivalent value. That means it's a promissory note, similar to what you carry in your pocket, promissory note. So if you have a promissory right. note, that is worth the money. That's what they sell. Okay, they only sell the note. They assign a mortgage. You can assign that because a mortgage has no value without the note. So they always assign the note. So why are you spending so much time worrying about MERS assigning the mortgage when they didn't assign the note? But many times you'll see MERS they'll have in there, and we don't read it. It says we're assigning the mortgage and all notes. Well, then that's when you say time. Now, MERS already admitted, and in their membership rules and in their regulations and in tens of thousands of court cases, they admit we don't ever hold or possess notes. Who gives a damn if MERS assigns a mortgage? I really don't care. Who's the note holder? And if you don't own the note and the note wasn't assigned, if the note is assigned, the mortgage follows. But if the mortgage is assigned, the note doesn't follow the mortgage. So who cares if they did a MERS assignment? Why are you spending time on that? You should laugh at that and be like, yeah, I've seen that. But if that's the only document that this pretender lender relies upon for standing, brother, you're not going to be standing for too long if you're standing in court with me. Because I'm going to take that MERS assignment and I'm going to wipe your butt with it. And I'm going to do it in all of 5 minutes, okay? I'm not going to spend a whole entire case arguing about MERS, and the listening audience should not do so either after what I just told you. All right?
Right, right.
Did I answer your question, brother, or do I need to go deeper?
No, you answered my question. I appreciate it. I just got to go check her paperwork and check her mortgage document and stuff and look for these words
right. If you're in default and that mortgage was assigned, okay, or
no,
transferred or sold, okay, she's not in default, then good. Because I tell people all the time, just because you're not in default, you still need to do research to determine whether you're dealing with a debt collector. Because like I said, a lot of times, many times, they don't tell you about the transfers of these notes or sales of these notes or even the fact that it was sold into the secondary market. So if you are current, you have a better chance at standing before a court of competent jurisdiction and a competent judge and say, I am not here trying to get out of paying my mortgage. I am here because I found some indications within my communications from this alleged creditor that they might have sold that loan into the secondary market, and I may be paying the wrong party, to which I am responsible for if I make every payment and don't receive a satisfaction of mortgage or receive the original note back as I am supposed to. It is my problem if I see certain things that cause me concern and I don't act upon it. So I'm here, Judge. I'm current. I'm going to continue paying this alleged lender until the court makes a declaratory judgment that they are not a lender at all. So I need these questions answered. I'm entitled to discovery and trial on the issues. You see what I mean? And that's a better situation for you to be in, because what can the judge say? Well, they're not trying to make the payments, and then while they're here, they still decided they're going to still make the payments because they want to protect their credit rating or they don't want to be wrong. But when the court decides, once the court makes that judgment that, you know what, yeah, we kind of agree with you, sounds like they're running some flim-flam on you and some Halloween on you, and they're acting like they're, you know, creditors when they're debt collectors. And if you get that agreed, then you're going to ask for all that money back plus interest and everything else. You see where I'm going with that?
Yeah, I see exactly where you're going with that.
All right, brother. Peace and blessings. Hopefully that helped. And continue to tune in to High Frequency Radio, brother. Thank you.
Brother, do you have an email that I can have?
Yes. It's going to be thelawmaster44@yahoo.com.
The Lawmaster44.
And you can also go back. Yes, and you can also go back and listen to the beginning of the call. I said it a couple of times from the beginning in case you lose it.
Okay. Thank you, brother. Thank you.
Thank you,
brother. Thank you,
sir. All right. Yes, sir. All right. We have 12 minutes left on the live stream, meaning that if you have any questions or want to continue listening to the show beyond the next 11 minutes and 50 seconds, you need to call in right now or you need to dial in on your Skype. Again, the call-in number is 424-222-5250. 424-222-5250. I will run about 30 minutes after the live stream, but I don't have many callers in, so there's no reason for me to proceed on. So I'll be closing probably within 15, 30 minutes, even after the stream closes out. All right, we're going to go to another caller here. Let's go up top, and let's go to 206-3098, 206-3098. You are on High Frequency Radio. Do you have a question, comment, or concern?
I have a question. Thank you, Brother Sharif, for your wisdom and knowledge and also sharing with this audience. Since I've been listening to your calls, I have been back and researching my paperwork. I am currently, they currently have a trustee sale schedule for my property. What I have done is I've gone back into the RCW laws. In fact, I'm in Washington, and I don't see an assignment from the alleged lender who was initially Washington Mutual and then it changed to J.P. Morgan to the alleged debt collector. But what they did file in the court records is an appointment of successor trustee. I noticed that at the bottom of that, they did not sign under penalty of perjury. And when I went to check out the notary with the within the state of Ohio, that they do not have that notary listed anywhere in their records, and nor does it say that they're signing under penalty of perjury, which leads me to think that, in fact, by the signature from the person at J.P. Morgan looks like an 18-year-old signature. And so, you know, it leads me to believe that, you know, that quality loan savings or quality loan, home loans or whatever the quality loan services has actually made it appear as though that they are assigning it to themselves. And also, I guess I have a question about whether or not when they file these documents, do they, if they are signing out of state, this one was signed in California, for them to sign this under the California law, is it legal in Washington State?
Okay. That's a good question. It's a question that will definitely help the rest of the listeners. And let me make you understand this. More than likely, nine times out of ten, if you have a Washington Mutual loan that was transferred over or J.P. Morgan Chase is alleging that it is a successor in interest to Washington Mutual, that is absolutely 100,000% not true. Washington Mutual, almost just like Countrywide, was some of the biggest securitizers in the mortgage arena, and they securitized most of their loans. And what's happening is that they kind of parade around a purchase and assumption agreement, which purports to allege that they bought the assets of JP of Washington Mutual, which they did, but it doesn't say anywhere that they bought specific loans enumerated by your loan number. So if you have a Washington Mutual JP mortgage situation, you are dealing with a debt collector, your loan was more than likely securitized. And I'm going to tell you where it was securitized. When the FDIC shut down Washington Mutual, okay, it took over Washington Mutual Bank, not Washington Mutual Investment. Okay, Washington Mutual WMI, which is Washington Mutual Investment, was the entity, a subsidiary, separate from Washington Mutual. And that company was responsible for selling the loans into the secondary market, which is securitization. So when Washington Mutual shut down, they only acquired Washington Mutual, not Washington Mutual Investments. You have cases out there where J.P. Morgan had – you can look up the case J.P. Morgan against versus Deutsche Bank, Deutsche Bank, however they want to pronounce it. In that case – where Deutsche Bank was suing J.P. Morgan and they were going, giving them the business, the way I say it, and they were like, well, we didn't acquire any loans from Washington Mutual, okay? And that's out there. That is litigation that can be used as statements, not hearsay, and can be authenticated that J.P. Morgan Chase has said that. Also, there was a recent multi-billion dollar settlement with the Justice Department. And the Justice Department laid out the fact in their agreement with them that they didn't acquire any loans from Washington Mutual Investments. They acquire certain property from Washington Mutual Bank. It could have been the parking lot. It could have been the vault. It could have been the calculators on the desk. It could have been some filing cabinets. It could have been some actual real property. But it doesn't. If it doesn't specify your specific loan, then J.P. Morgan Chase, okay, did not acquire any loans from their purchase of Washington Mutual. And that's public knowledge, and you can Google that and find some pretty good information that will support what I just said. So in essence, you're dealing with a debt collector with J.P. Morgan Chase, and that's just simple and plain. And there's been J.P. Morgan has been losing cases. The Michigan Supreme Court also made that determination that J.P. Morgan Chase never acquired any loans from Washington Mutual. And I believe there was recently, I can't name it off, I think there was another Supreme Court, maybe Washington, that came to that determination as well. So the information is out there, and it's pretty thorough, okay? They parade around a purchase and assumption agreement that's about 130 pages, but in a deposition, with an employee from J.P. Morgan Chase, there was actually a 130-page document that kind of laid out more what they bought and what they didn't buy. And the FDIC has sort of said that, yeah, you really didn't buy any loans. Because if Washington Mutual Investment did the securitization of the loans, when Washington Mutual shut down, there was no loans to acquire because they had already been sold into the secondary market by its subsidiary, Washington Mutual Investments. And Washington Mutual Investments was never confiscated or seized by the FDIC or the Office of the Comptroller. So that means it's a separate organization. And J.P. Morgan even tried to sue Washington Mutual Investments and said, we need those loans. We need the documents. We need to have some standing because we're doing foreclosures. And Washington Mutual Investments was like, basically, go to hell. We're not giving you anything. So those loans were sold prior to J.P. Morgan acquiring Washington Mutual. So rest assured that more than likely, no, you don't owe J.P. Morgan Chase any money. And they need to prove that they acquired your loan, your loan number and amount, and show some documentation supporting that fact that they purchased your loan from them. Nine times out of ten, that didn't happen.
Okay. Now, what about the, like I said, I never saw a transfer of interest that I, you know, it's a document that I looked up in our RCW codes, which states that if a creditor is to transfer interest, that they are to do it on a certain, on a specific form. I never saw that in the county record, nor did I. What I did see was the appointment of successor trustee, and it's notarized by someone that is not even a notary in their state.
Well, definitely, you have a good case for going out, and you will find that a lot of times. You will find robo-signers as well as robo-notaries. You will find notarizations on documents, and I was able to, since I have access to much information, I had a case one time when we were doing, I did a background check on a notary and found out she had flew to Nebraska on the day this was notarized. So when you really start getting into your research and investigation and you really want to go after them, then you use those tools and said, this document was notarized falsely. Okay, it was notarized by a person that didn't have the capacity to issue to notarize a document because her notary was not commissioned by the state. Okay, so you
okay.
Definitely. So
you, wonderful. And the last
ability to go
that
after
have.
That notary. I'm sorry.
Okay, very good. The other question that I have is that I have also done an acceptance of my statutory deed. Does that have any power in this whole mortgage process?
Processes, acceptance of deed, you know, acceptance for value, and things of that nature. You know, I really don't know anything about that. I don't say that they work and they don't work. What I do say is that I can't find that in any particular law book, statute, or code that gives me a private right of action to do those type of processes. So if I can't get paid off of it, or if I can't put it as a defense, okay, or as an offense in a pleading, I don't do it, okay? So I don't know anything about that except in a deed and things of that nature. Those are things I hear around in the Patriot community, but I don't know of any successes or anybody that's received a check because, you know, you accepted a deed and somehow that's going to make your mortgage problems go away. I'm going to state on the record that. Okay. We got 90 seconds left. Hopefully that answered your question. I want to let the listening audience know that the webinar will be on Friday. You need to email me directly at thelawmaster44@yahoo.com to participate in the webinar. If you guys are not familiar or don't know, my webinars fill up pretty fast. On the webinar, I'll be going over debt collection and the things that needs to be done to sue and actually get you a check from a debt collector. So it will be a significant webinar. Everybody needs to sign up. You need to sign up by contacting me at thelawmaster44@yahoo.com to participate in that webinar this coming Friday. You will receive information and particulars about how to log on and what information, access code, and other things you may need. I thank everybody for showing up to the call today. Hopefully it was a blessing and enlightenment to those that needs the information. We will return here next Tuesday. Same time, 11 o'clock. I want to give all honors to Brother Youssef, Brother Savage, and all the other commentators and hosts that appear on the network. The network will grow, and we will be providing more information in different avenues on different aspects of all issues of society that plague or restrain us. Again, thank you for showing up. Thank you for joining. I'm going to cease the call at this time. We'll see you next week, same time. God bless.
Let's get ready to rumble! You know.